once upon a time, the so-called Dixiecrats, the segregationist Southern Democrats, Strom Thurmond, back when he was a Democrat, was very involved. They understand that they're going to be able to endure through any administration. They're not outsiders asking for power. They're insiders. So I think Obama's politics are not are to the left of most of the membership, but that doesn't mean they wither up. And these are not the folks, for the most part, who are, you know, saying that Obama's the Antichrist or anything like that. We're talking about people who they're not fringe fundamentalists. They're sophisticated, educated, international people. They're not going to use that almost insane rhetoric.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Tickling the Belly of the Beast from the heartland of Santa Cruz. Sorry to interrupt that program. Actually, that was another one that I had done a while ago. But this is Janaea, and I'm going to be your host today. And co-hosting with me is
Thomas Miller.
He was a guest here before, and he was great, so I asked him to come back. And we've got a great lineup for you.
We're going to have fun doing so.
We certainly are. We're going to start from 3 to 4. We're going to be speaking with Charles Eisenstein, and he wrote The Ascent of Humanity. It's the age of separation, the age of reunion, and the convergence of crises. He also, pieces of this book have been read on Unwelcome Guests, which is also played here. And then from 4 to 5, we're going to be speaking with Frank Dorrell. And he created a film, The War Against the Third World, What I've Learned About U.S. Foreign Policy. And also his published wonderful book, Addicted to War, Why the U.S. Can't Kick Militarism. But before we get started with the interviews, we're going to play some segments from Frank's DVD, and the first one is about, what was his name? Brian Wilson. And he was a local Santa Cruzan that had spent some time in Central America. And the video speaks for itself. He was run over by a train protesting, I believe, our involvement in Nicaragua at the time.
Yes, that's what it was. It was up at the at Richmond, the weapons shipping point for a lot of the weapons that ended up going to not only Central America, but Vietnam.
Yeah. Thank you for that clarification. I know it's play the DVD from The War Against the Third World, and it's Brian Wilson.
Self-destruction.
Starts with Chris
Christopherson.
He acted
on his faith in the unity and sanctity of all life, and that if one person will speak and act upon this truth, it will open the hearts of many and provide us a way out in this most desperate moment.
5% of the people of the world live in the United States, but we consume 40% of the resources of the world. We have become used to thinking that we have a right to all that we have, no matter what damage we do to the earth or to other people. We have become detached and disconnected from reality. We have become detached from the earth. We have become detached from the feelings and lives of people elsewhere if it interferes with our right to maintain our lifestyle and standard of living. I would submit to you that we're on a course leading to inevitable annihilation. Martin Luther King said, the issue is not between violence and nonviolence, it's between nonviolence and non-existence. The course we're on in the first world is a course of ultimate destruction. Do we want to be part of this course of ultimate destruction, or do we want to be part of hope and affirmation and justice for all people of the earth and for the earth itself, without which we cannot live? Yes, I'm talking about a nonviolent revolution of consciousness, a consciousness that is able to understand how we're all inextricably connected to each other on this earth and to the earth itself. And that if we violate those fundamental principles, we do so at our own peril. Yes, we can continue to live in this delusion and the denials of reality because it's painful. It's frightening. Sometimes it's terrifying. Just as Vietnam vets have understood, it's terrifying to face the truth, especially when you don't have anybody to talk to. How can we continue as a civilization of we the people if we have to do it at the expense of maiming and murder of people all over the world, whether it's in Angola or El Salvador or Guatemala or Nicaragua or Cambodia or Vietnam or South Africa? Are we going to watch this happen again? Do we just go about our business as usual and know that another 5,000 people will be killed in our name? Or do we have to think about a paradigm shift that somehow is able to experience the anguish of the earth and the anguish of the Nicaraguans and the anguish of the El Salvadorans, whose lives are being threatened by our guns and our money, because we have to protect our national security? Well, I hope and I challenge all of you to think, but more importantly to feel in your heart, how you might be able to act in such a way so that the world can live in peace and justice. And I'm liberated. I'm free to stand anywhere, any place, and tell them they cannot continue to kill mothers and fathers and children in my name as a citizen of the United States. So I ask each of you to search your hearts as to what your truth is for being a citizen of the earth, promoting justice as a foundation for peace. It's not going to happen magically, and I think it's not going to happen by relying on these political structures and institutions in Washington. I think we're going to have to wage peace in the most extraordinary ways, whether our government wants it or not. And so I simply say that you will know in your heart, I believe, what to do. But I know that without a nonviolent revolution of consciousness, we will not survive as a civilization or as a planet. We are at an extraordinary point in history where we can choose to have peace if we want to pay the price. And what more glorious goal and value do we want than peace for all people? And so I look forward to working together with you all, with we the people, to build a new society, a society that understands that we are not worth more and they are not worth less, and that we will be willing to pay the price and take the risks to wage peace with all fellow and sister human beings.
I feel ever more empowered to wage unconditional peace
Unidos, jamás serán vencidos.
Well, that was the segment on Brian Wilson. Now you're going to hear, there's a shorter one on Ramsey Clark, the former Attorney General of the United States. And in this segment, he's speaking in 1998 in Los Angeles at a gathering entitled Save the Iraqi Children. And here it is, Ramsey Clark.
Some long evenings, because this planet is deeply troubled, and the greatest cause of that trouble is our own government. In the speech that Reverend James Lawson referred to, that Martin Luther King made on April the 5th, 1967, the most startling thing that he said at the time, the thing that caused the most anger and hatred to be directed toward him, was this sentence: "The greatest purveyor of violence on earth is my own government." 31 years ago, why anyone would have been startled is hard to say, because it was an obvious fact. But apparently we need more education in the obvious than we do examination of the obscure and unknown. Last year, U.S. military expenditures, with all the suffering on the planet, all the sickness and hunger and ignorance and pain, the American military budget was $265 billion. The second largest government expenditure for militarism was $48 billion, and that was the Russian Federation. The United States military expenditures exceed those of the top 12 government expenditures on Earth by themselves, and are more than a third of all the military expenditures on the planet. We have a war party in this country, and we've had it all along. And you can call it Democrat for a while, you can call it Republican for a while, but it has been the special economic interests in this society that have governed us from the time that we founded our governments on this continent. And the people have never controlled those governments. We call ourselves the world's greatest democracy. We are absolutely a plutocracy. It's the most obvious thing in the world. Wealth governs this country. And wealth uses military violence to control the rest of the world as best it can. And we're responsible. And we will pay the price for it. If we don't control our violence, if we don't control the effect of the symbol of our glorification of violence on our children and on the rest of the planet, then this human species is going to be the first to destroy itself completely. And that's the road the United States government has put us on. The single most pertinent statement on this issue was by Henry Kissinger. When the Iran-Iraq war began, over a million very young men lost their lives in that war. Henry Kissinger said at the beginning of the war, 8 years of war, "I hope they kill each other." And that was exactly our policy. What could be better? Have them kill each other. Then who has to worry about that region anymore, you know? And don't think that's not exactly our policy. All over the world where there are poor peoples living today, that's the solution to overpopulation. Call it triage, whatever you want to call it. Let them kill each other. Let them die. And they're dying all over Asia, Africa, and Latin America, where the masses of poor people live. They're expendable there as they are expendable here. As appalling as what we've done and what we've threatened to Iraq, the worst violence that all of our technology could unleash, and then the strangulation of the sanctions. The thing we have to realize is it's what our government leadership has been doing all along. It's not terribly different than how we addressed the folks that were here to meet the Mayflower standing on the dock, the North American Aboriginal peoples, the Indians as we call them. A long, steady course of destruction of those peoples. It's not terribly different than what we did to the slaves that were brought over in chains from Africa, those that survived the transit, which wasn't easy. You look in our history books, you don't read about a Philippine-American war. You read the Philippine history books, and they know about a Philippine-American war. We call it the Spanish-American War. We were liberating the Filipinos. We killed more than a million. Now we're bragging about the covert actions we're going to engage in against Iraq. Do you doubt for a minute that they're planning covert actions in half a dozen other places right now? That we'll react to them 5 years after the misery has begun and the people have been devastated? What we have to realize is that if we don't stand up and stop this now, if we can't stop these sanctions in Iraq, and if with them we can't prohibit any further use of sanctions that are designed to impact on the poor, then there are no poor people on the planet that will ever be safe from our government and its future acts. It's imperative that we stop them in Iraq today and that we prohibit them in the future as applied to any people, because it is a weapon of mass destruction. We have to stop military interventions by our government completely. We cannot permit more U.S. military interventions in foreign countries. We have to stop economic interventions. We've got to cancel foreign debt that has enslaved most of the poor countries of the planet. Cancel it. So let's organize through every effort and opportunity we have in our families, in our churches, in our mosques, in our synagogues, and in our schools, and at our jobs, a massive coalition committed to end militarism and economic exploitation.
Oh, that was Ramsey Clark. The next segment we're going to hear from the War Against the Third World, is Philip Agee, is the former CIA case officer, since passed away. Amazing man. He spent 13 years in the CIA before resigning, and his book, Inside the Conspiracy, CIA Diary, was something else. And I'm going to download his speech. I'm not sure where it was, but it is on this DVD, The War Against the Third World. And we will be having on the producer of that at 4. But right now we're going to be listening to Phil Agee.
Well, we all know, don't we, the reasons why the United States intervened in the Gulf the way we did. In the end, killing between 100,000 and 200,000 Iraqis, as opposed to 303, I think, Americans killed either in combat or in combat-related accidents. And we certainly have restored to power the legitimate authority in Kuwait. In fact, we've done it applying that age-old, all-American political principle of one man, one vote. In this case, one man, the emir, one vote, his. We heard Bush back in August, didn't we, at the very beginning saying that our way of life was at stake. We had to do something about that invasion of Kuwait. We also heard, didn't we, besides the way of life was at stake, we had to intervene to protect the access to the energy resources of the Persian Gulf. Another one was that we had to stop naked aggression. What we did not get are alternative interpretations of the events that occurred. And that's what I want to speak about here tonight. It's my opinion that the United States needed an international crisis, an international threat, to replace the crisis in Europe that largely disappeared with the collapse of communism and the chaos in the Soviet Union. Why? In order to keep the permanent war economy going, to justify continuing the situation wherein well more than 50% of the federal budget goes to military purposes. Well, this means that the military expenditures in the United States are the motor of the U.S. economy, and they have been that ever since about 1950. It's worth reviewing the history because that's where this crisis, I think, comes from, this sought-for, needed crisis. In early 1950, there was extreme worry at the highest levels of the Truman administration that the United States was likely to return to the conditions of the Great Depression of the 1930s. And so early in 1950, the decision was taken that this domestic economic problem was going to be solved through militarism, that is, through rearmament in the United States and through U.S. financing of the rearmament of Western Europe, particularly Western Germany. The document which provides the analysis of the world at that time and the U.S. place in the world and the internal situation in the United States was top secret for 25 years. In 1975, it was accidentally or through error released and published. It is known as NSC 68. It was written by NSC, standing for National Security Council. It was written by Paul Nitze, and it is a very detailed document. The main operative conclusion, though, was this. This is a quote from the document. The United States and other free nations will, within a period of a few years at most, experience a decline in economic activity of serious proportions unless more positive governmental programs are developed. Well, the solution adopted those more positive governmental programs was expansion of the military. But Truman could not get this program through Congress at first. There was opposition there and public opposition to the enormous new taxes that this program would require. He went on national radio, declared a state of national emergency, and said what Bush's remarks about our way of life being at stake reminded me of. He mustered all the hype and emotion he could, and Truman said, among other things, he said, our homes, our nation, all the things that we believe in are in great danger. This danger has been created by the rulers of the Soviet Union. In his speech, he also called for massive increases in military spending for U.S. and European forces, quite apart from the needs in Korea. Well, there was no threat from the Soviet Union. They were still rebuilding from the rubble of World War II, in which they had lost 20 million people. They were no threat, but they were manufactured from 1950 on, from the time of Korea on, as a grave threat to the United States. And that became the justification for this program, which Truman, through manipulation of the Korean War, had been able finally to get through Congress. The result was that in the first 2 years, that is, the 2 years between 1950 and 1952, the U.S. military budget more than tripled from $13 billion in 1950 to $44 billion in 1952. And during the same two-year period, U.S. military forces doubled to 3.6 million people under arms. This was the beginning of the permanent war economy in the United States. The Korean War, by the way, went on for three more years after it could have ended. In the end, 34,000 U.S. were dead, more or less, more than 100,000 wounded, and the total casualty count was in the millions. It is worth recalling that because from 1950 on, the Soviet threat was the justification for the permanent war economy and the justification for these enormous military expenditures. What does that mean in far as the United States is concerned? Well, it means that we have not addressed or begun to solve the many domestic crises that we all know exist. There's no need really to go through this litany of the worst educational system in the developed world. One in three in this country illiterate, either totally or to the degree that they cannot function in a society based on the written word. Healthcare, not just the cost, but the fact that 40 million people in this country have no health insurance, the only developed country in the world with no national health plan, and on, the fact that only about, what is it, 60%, about two-thirds of the eligible voters register to vote. And of those who register, only about 80% actually vote, so only in the end, 50% of the eligible voters vote in national elections in this country. And that means that a president is elected with around 24-25% of the potential vote. The litany goes on, the environment, the infrastructure, finding a prevention and cure for AIDS, the violence we see everywhere and in every form in the United States. When you put all these things together, I don't think anyone would argue, add drugs, of course, anyone would argue that we have a domestic society in profound crisis. And the reason why, over all these years, these crises have not been solved is, in my opinion, because those who really control and rule the United States don't want them solved. Imagine what would happen if we had an informed electorate, if we didn't have the worst educational system, if we had a negligible, perhaps, illiteracy rate here. There might be an informed electorate. We might be debating real substantive issues in the electoral process or in the political process in the United States. There might be a threat in this country of real democracy if we solved the domestic crises in this country. People might clamor to participate if there was a real debate. There might be a threat of a third party, I mean a second party, in the United States. There are all kinds of threats to elitist control of the United States if we were to solve these domestic crises, in my opinion. And it is for this reason that we have always needed this foreign threat and this foreign crisis in order to justify putting the money into military expenditures instead of converting the economy once and for all to human purposes. During those 40-odd years of the Cold War, the CIA has been a very important factor or tool or instrument of the President of the United States in waging what is continuing today. This new world order of George Bush, or new international order, seems to me to be nothing more really than the institutionalization of the North-South dimension of the old Cold War, that is the war against the Third World for control of their natural resources, their labor, and their markets.
Stay with us. We're getting part two of that. Here he is.
Or instrument of the President of the United States in waging what is continuing today. This new world order of George Bush, or new international order, seems to me to be nothing more, really, than the institutionalization of the North-South dimension of the old Cold War, that is, the war against the Third World for control of their natural resources, their labor, and their markets. That is where the fighting really took place, as in Vietnam. This North-South dimension of the Cold War, the war against the Third World, continues today as we sit here with all its racist content. And we and our allies, that is the United States and its allies, are just as dependent, if not more, on the resources of these countries in the Third World as they ever were. And that dependency is not going to disappear. It's going to keep on growing through the years. So what I think Bush has in mind is, through this Persian Gulf crisis, to send a message to any aspiring Third World leader that Third World radical nationalism will not be tolerated. It is a way in which, in fact, we are beginning to treat the Third World, or continuing to treat the Third World, like we treat Third World people right here in the United States. They know their place, they have a role to perform, and they're expected to do it. If they don't, if they make trouble, they're going to be smashed. That is what happened, of course, with Iraq. I believe that Bush encouraged the Hussein administration and Saddam Hussein himself to believe that they could get away with taking over Kuwait with impunity. And there are many signs that point in this direction. Iraq never really formally recognized the independence of Kuwait. They have always claimed that Kuwait was part of Iraq taken away by British imperialism, which is indeed the case. Last April, Assistant Secretary of State John Kelly testified before Congress that the United States had no commitment to defend Kuwait. On July 25th, the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, April Glaspie, meets with Hussein. Among other things, the U.S. ambassador says to Hussein, "Mr. President, I have a direct instruction from Secretary of State Baker to emphasize to you that the United States has, quote unquote, no opinion on your disputes with Kuwait, particularly your border disputes with Kuwait." She also said, "I have an instruction from President Bush to seek better relations with Iraq." President Hussein, in response, in several places, says that what Kuwait is doing through its overproduction is the equivalent to war against Iraq. They are destroying the Iraqi economy, he said, and we are going to take strong action. He as much as said that they were going to go to war. Well, in this meeting, with those 100,000 troops on the border, not one word from the U.S. ambassador of warning to Hussein not to invade. Well, put all those things together, and you have to ask yourself the question, why did the Bush administration do nothing during that last week between the ambassador's meeting with Hussein and the invasion itself to prevent that invasion? They knew those 100,000 troops were there, but not one word from Glaspie to Hussein about it. My conclusion is that they wanted the invasion, that this was the site selected for the new international crisis that would justify continuation of the war economy in the United States. It was totally avoidable, objectively speaking, but because of the tradition in the United States, after all, we are a warrior culture, we do still live in the age of imperialism, and the demands of this system require this crisis. I go back to the CIA for just a moment because it's worth recalling that the agency from the very beginning of the 1940s, was used not only to collect intelligence from around the world, process it, and present it to policymakers like the president for their decisions, or to help them in their decisions. Obviously, that's what an intelligence service should do. But the CIA was used all through these years to subvert the democratic processes of other countries. At the very first meeting of the National Security Council, which was set up in the same law that established the CIA as the National Intelligence Service, this was October 1947, 1 month after Truman signed this bill into law, establishing the CIA and the National Security Council as the highest policymaking body in national security and foreign affairs. At their very first meeting in October 1947, the decision was taken to set aside $10 million for the CIA to intervene secretly in the Italian elections coming up about 6 months later. The CIA was not just used in these electoral operations. You know, the media operations were vast, and I'm sure they still are. Media operations basically means that the CIA pays a foreign journalist to publish the CIA's material as if it were the journalist's own. There were CIA interventions of all sorts, but one area I want to mention of special importance are what are known as liaison operations. Liaison operations are all those activities that the CIA undertakes with the intelligence and security services of other countries. Early on, the CIA began to set up security and intelligence services in other countries for purposes of internal security. One of the first places was Greece. There was a civil war, you know, in Greece in 1947 to 1949. The United States intervened on the side of the far right in Greece, and the U.S. side won. In the aftermath, the CIA set up a security service known as the KYP, or KEEP, KYP being the Greek initials for CIA. They gave it the same name. This security service was used to keep the far right in power in Greece for nearly 20 years. But when that power was threatened with upcoming elections in 1967, the CIA and this service, KYP, organized a military coup in Greece, which was successful, leading to 7 years of military dictatorship in Greece, of neo-fascist stripe. During that period, torture became an institution in Greece. Thousands of Greeks were forced into exile. I could give you many, many examples of this. In Iran, for example, in 1954, the CIA, 1953, the CIA undermined the elected, democratically elected civilian government of the day, of Mohammad Mossadegh, overthrew that government, installed the Shah as military dictator, and in the aftermath set up a service called the SAVAK. This service, over the 25 years of the Shah's regime, became famous for its torture chambers and its assassinations of the Shah's political opponents. 1954, the U.S., the CIA, intervenes in Guatemala, undermines the civilian government, the government is overthrown, and from 1954 on, Guatemala has had one succession of military rulers after another, a military dictatorship. In the aftermath of this operation in 1954, the CIA set up an internal security service, and then others. But from these services, set up and supported by the CIA all through the years, came intervenes in Guatemala, undermines the civilian government, the government is overthrown, and from 1954 on, Guatemala has had one succession of military rulers after another, a military dictatorship. In the aftermath of this operation in 1954, the CIA set up an internal security service, and then others. But from these services, set up and supported by the CIA all through the years, came the death squads. In other words, the services established by the CIA then spawned these death squads in Guatemala. The very same thing in El Salvador. You can be as sure as you are of your own name that for the last 10 or 11 years, the CIA has been working in there day and night with those Salvadoran security services and military, collecting information, giving it to those services, which in turn are the same things as the death squads. Information on activists in the human rights field, the student leadership, trade unions, and so forth. And those have constituted the 75,000 or so people who have been murdered over 10 or 11 years in El Salvador. Disappeared, many of them, others tortured to death, their bodies thrown along the sides of the roads. Nobody knows how many have been killed in Guatemala by these military regimes, which started with the CIA. Some say 100,000, some say 125,000. Some say 150,000. Who knows? Nobody will ever really know the exact number who have been killed. But you multiply this around the world, because I'm only mentioning a couple of examples of these CIA operations. There have been now 44 years of this, and they have existed all around the world. And put those operations together with the overt military interventions and the enormous cost in human life of those, such as Grenada, Panama, Iraq, Vietnam, for example, all of those, and you get the picture of this expansionist, extremely aggressive U.S. foreign policy. Well, I don't think it's enough really to describe what the CIA does or U.S. foreign policy in general. It's also necessary to ask a couple of questions. And going back to the Gulf for just a moment, consider this analysis of what really happened in the Gulf. You know that the United States has been exporting war materiel for decades, beginning right around 1950 with the document I mentioned earlier. Tanks, guns of every sort, weapons, planes, ships, and military equipment of every sort. Well, with a national debt of $3.5 trillion in this country, 800 billion of it owned by foreigners. For handling of that debt, it seems that it was only a matter of time before the U.S. armed forces were sent abroad as one more export. Because what we did in the Persian Gulf crisis was to send abroad that enormous amount of military hardware. But this time, we also exported the people to operate it. It was armed forces sent abroad to protect the resources and the regimes, these family dictatorships of the sheikdoms of the Persian Gulf. What we did, in fact, was what we in the United States do the best. We made war. And we were financed in this exercise by the people who make things that people around the world want, cars, VCRs, and so forth, financed mainly by the Japanese and the Germans. And that puts the United States, as it's going to have a permanent presence in the Persian Gulf, in a very strong position vis-a-vis the Japanese and the Germans, who are not there militarily. And they are going to depend to a great degree for their energy resources, at least from that region, on U.S. policy. That is why they went along with the war. That is an interpretation of the Gulf crisis. And the other question that I wanted to raise is why we do these things as a country. Why we do these as a society, as a nation. Why do we do these grisly things abroad? I believe strongly that until we have fundamental change in the United States, domestically, in the domestic system, until we have some kind of real democracy in this country, participatory democracy, where people have a say, and where we end the re-election of 95 to 97% of incumbents at every election, where there is a real political debate, until we change the domestic system, we're going to have elitist control of the United States, we're going to have these foreign adventures and the grisly things, as I mentioned, that the CIA does abroad. So the real problem is here at home, in changing the domestic system, in bringing about a conversion of the economy to human purposes, solving the domestic crises, and getting the people out of office who are in there to back a continuation of the permanent war economy.
Well, thank you, Phil Agee, for speaking such truth.
And now I've got a song to share that it started from a place of my observing U.S. foreign policy to the big events in my younger years was the Vietnam War and also the war on Nicaragua, the Contra War. I had the opportunity to go down to Nicaragua for 6 weeks with the Bay Area Construction Brigade, and upon return, pretty much dropped out of any kind of political activism because of my despair and despondency about mm-hmm. what seemed to be an overwhelming element.
Which we'll be addressing that with Charles Eisenstein
right.
in terms of the age of separation and despair and which how to transcend that.
Yeah, which
your
is...
Your life parallels. Sorry about that. You were paralyzed possibly.
I've been paralyzed, but I am no longer, so...
Here's far from it.
Here's this song.
Back in 1956, over in Vietnam, the United Nations declared it was time for free elections. Ho Chi Minh was sure to win, a national hero, so the United States government stopped those elections, did you know? Ho ho, come and fight for me, says Uncle Sam, I'm gonna keep them free, free to do what they are told. Or die if they say no. Free to do what they are told. Or die if they say no. For 50 years Nicaragua suffered Somoza's rule, but the people band together and the tyrants overthrew. And now their government's for the people, not business or privileged few. And my country's sons terrorists and claims her freedom's tools. Hey, hey, come and fight for me, says Uncle Sam, I'll pay your fee. You're free to do what you are told. They're free to die if they say no. You're free to do what you are told. They're free to die if you say no.
And here's the part that's actually completely topical. Yes, and in real time.
These are all historically relevant.
Yes.
Because this is continuing.
Yes, so.
Now you're 18 and a man tells you to sign your name on top of some U.S. government line.
Yes.
They might tell you to go and kill in someone else's land. It's your spirit. Don't do it. But you're gonna have to take a stand. It's your spirit, don't you do it. But you'll have to take a stand. Hey, hey, come and fight for me. Says Uncle Sam, I'll keep you free. Free to do what you are told. Go to jail if you say no. Free to do what you are told. Go to jail if you say no.
And how many young people are struggling with that today?
Without,
they need our prayers.
Yes, with the not seeming to have a lot of options economically, more young people are tempted and turning toward employment in the military.
I just spoke to a woman yesterday, a coworker, who said that her nephew tried to, I think he's trying to get all three of the branches of the military, and he can't. There's such a deluge of applicants right now. It's amazing, and I kept my mouth shut and later suggested he try something else and can pursue that with just as much fervor.
Well, on the other side of the coin, too, I hear the same thing is true with the Peace Corps. That there's
there's
a lot of people that are looking to go into the Peace Corps, and it's a competitive situation now to get in. So
there's AmeriCorps also. I wonder how they're doing.
That's a good question. I have no idea.
I see them going on a radio in AmeriCorps. But anyway, we're going to move on here and read a little article entitled A Gathering of the Tribe, and that is by Charles Eisenstein on his website, Reality Sandwich, which is amazing. A lot of interesting articles and monologues, tales of the spirit. But we'll get started with that. Let me see. I'll start and then I'll let my friend over here read a bit. Okay, this is by Charles Eisenstein, A Gathering of the Tribe. Once upon a time, a great tribe of people lived in a world far away from ours. Whether far away in space or in time, or even outside of time, we do not know. They lived in a state of enchantment and joy that few of us today dare to believe could exist, except in those exceptional peak experiences when we glimpse the true potential of life and mind. One day, the shaman of the tribe called a meeting. They gathered around him, and he spoke very solemnly. "My friends," he said, "there is a world that needs our help, and it is called Earth, and its fate hangs in the balance. Its humans have reached a critical point in their collective birthing, and they will be stillborn without our help. Who would like to volunteer for a mission to this time and place and render service to humanity?"
"Tell us more about his mission," they asked. "I am glad you asked, because it is no small thing. I will put you into a deep, deep trance, so complete that you will forget who you are. You will live a human life, and in the beginning you will completely forget your origins. You will forget even our language and your own true name. You will be separated from the wonder and beauty of our world and from the love that bathes us all. You will miss it deeply, yet you will not know what it is you are missing. You will only remember the love and beauty that we know to be normal as a longing in your heart. Your memory will take the form of an intuitive knowledge as you plunge into the painfully marred earth that a more beautiful world is possible. As you grow up in that world, your knowledge will be under constant assault. You will be told in a million ways that a world of destruction, violence, drudgery, anxiety, and degradation is normal. You may go through a time when you are completely alone, with no allies to affirm your knowledge of a more beautiful world. You may plunge into a depth of despair that we, in our world of light, cannot imagine. But no matter what, a spark of knowledge will never leave you. A memory of your true origin will be encoded in your DNA. That spark will lie within you, inextinguishable, until one day it is awakened. You see, even though you will feel, for a time, utterly alone, you will not be alone. I will send you assistance, help, that you will experience as miraculous, experiences that you will describe as transcendent. For a few moments, or hours, or days, you will reawaken to the beauty and the joy that is meant to be. You will see it on Earth, for even though the planet and its people are deeply wounded, there is beauty there still, projected from past and future onto the present as a promise of what is possible and a reminder of what is real.
You will also receive help from each other. As you begin to awaken to your mission, you will meet others of our tribe. You will recognize them by your common purpose, values, and intuitions, and by the similarity of the paths you have walked. As the condition of the planet Earth reaches crisis proportions, your paths will cross more and more. The time of loneliness, the time of thinking you might be crazy, will be over. You will find the people of your tribe all over the earth and become aware of them through the long-distance communication technologies used on that planet. For the real shift, the real quickening, will happen in face-to-face gatherings in special places on Earth. When many of you gather together, you will launch a new stage on your journey, a journey which, I assure you, will end where it began. Then the mission that lay unconscious within you will flower into consciousness. Your intuitive rebellion against the world presented you as normal will become an explicit quest to create a more beautiful one. In the time of loneliness, you will always be seeking to reassure yourself that you are not crazy. You will do that by telling people all about what is wrong with the world, and you will feel a sense of betrayal when they don't listen to you. You will be hungry for stories of wrongness, atrocity, and ecological destruction, all of which confirm the validity of your intuition that a more beautiful world exists. But after you have fully received the help I will send you and the quickening of your gatherings, you will no longer need to do that, because you will know. Your energy will thereafter turn toward actively creating that more beautiful world. A tribeswoman asked the shaman, "How do you know this will work? Are you sure your shamanic powers are great enough to send us on such a journey?"
The shaman replied, "I know it will work, because I have done it many times before. Many have already been sent to Earth to live human lives and to lay the groundwork for the mission you will undertake now. I've been practicing. The only difference now is that many of you will venture there at once. What is new in the time you will live in is that the gatherings are beginning to happen." A tribesman asked, "Is there a danger we will become lost in that world and never wake up from the shamanic trance? Is there a danger that the despair, the cynicism, the pain of separation will be so great that it will extinguish the spark of hope, the spark of our true selves and origin, and that we will be separated from our beloved ones forever?" The shaman replied, "That is impossible. The more deeply you get lost, the more powerful the help I will send you. You might experience it at the time as a collapse of your personal world, the loss of everything important to you. Later, you will recognize the gift within it. We will never abandon you." Another man asked, "Is it possible that our mission will fail and that this planet Earth will perish?" The shaman replied, "I will answer your question with a paradox. It is impossible that your mission will fail. Yet, its success hangs on your own actions. The fate of the world is in your hands. The key to this paradox lies within you, in the feeling you carry that each of your actions, even your personal secret struggles within, has cosmic significance. You will know then, as you do now, that everything you do matters. Everything you do matters. God sees everything." There were no more questions. The volunteers gathered in a circle, and the shaman went to each one. The last thing each was aware of was the shaman blowing smoke in his face. They entered a deep trance and dreamed themselves into the world where we find ourselves today.
Who are the missionaries from the more beautiful world? You and I are surely among them. Where else could this longing come from, for this magical place to be found nowhere on earth, this beautiful time outside of time? It comes from our intuitive knowledge of our origin and destination. The longing, indomitable, will never settle for a world that is less. Against all reason, we look upon the horrors of our age mounting over the millennia, and we say, no, it does not have to be this way. We know it because we have been there. We carry in our souls the knowledge that a more beautiful world is possible. Reason says it is impossible. Reason says that even to slow, much less reverse, the degradation of the planet is an impossible task. Politically unfeasible, opposed by the money power and its oligarchies. It is time that those powers will fight to uphold the world we have known. Their allies lurk within even ourselves, a despair, cynicism, and resignation to carving out a life that is good enough for me and mine. But we of the tribe know better. In the darkest despair, a spark of hope lies indistinguishable within us, ready to be fanned into flames at the slightest turn of good news. However compelling the cynicism, an idealism lives within us, always ready to believe, always ready to look upon new possibilities with fresh eyes, surviving despite infinite disappointments. And however resigned we may have felt, our grandest might of me and mine is half-hearted, for part of our energy is looking elsewhere, outward toward our true mission. I would like to advise caution against dividing the world into two types of people, those who are of the tribe and those who are not. How often have you felt like an alien in a world of people who don't get it and don't care? The irony is that nearly everyone feels that way, deep down. When we are young, the feeling of mission...
And the sense of magnificent origins and a magnificent destination is strong. Any career or way of life lived in betrayal of that knowing is painful and can only be maintained through an inner struggle that shuts down a part of our being. For a time, we can keep ourselves functioning through various kinds of addictions or trivial pleasures to consume the life force and dull the pain. In earlier times, we might have kept the sense of mission and destiny buried for a lifetime and called that condition maturity. Times are changing now, though, as millions of people are awakening to their mission all at the same time. The condition of the planet is waking us up. Another way to put it is that we are becoming young again. When you feel that sense of alienation, when you look upon that sea of faces mired so inextricably in the old world and fighting to maintain it, think back to a time when you too were, to all outside appearances, a full and willing participant in that world as well. The same spark of revolution you carried then, the same secret refusal dwells in all people. How was it that you finally stopped fighting it? How was it that you came to realize that you were right all along, and that the world offered to us is wrong, and that no life is worth living that does not in some way strive to create a better one? How was it that you became intolerable to devote your, it became intolerable to devote your life energy toward the perpetuation of the old world? Most likely, it happened when the old world fell apart around your ears. As the multiple crises of money, health, energy, ecology, and more converge upon us, the world is going to collapse for millions more. We must stand ready to welcome them into the tribe. We must stand ready to welcome them back home. The time of loneliness, of walking the path alone, of thinking maybe the world is right and I am wrong for refusing to participate fully in it, that time is over. For years, we walked around talking about how wrong everything is. The political system, the education system, religious institutions, the military-industrial complex, the banking industry, the medical system, Really, any system you study deeply enough. We needed to talk about it because we needed to assure ourselves that we were not, in fact, crazy. We needed as well to talk about alternatives the way things should be. We should eliminate CFCs. They should stop cutting down the rainforests. The government should declare no fishing zones. This talk, too, was necessary, for it validated our vision of the world that could be a peaceful and exuberant humanity living in co-creative partnership with a wild garden earth. The time, though, for talking merely to assure ourselves that we are right is coming to an end. People everywhere are tired of it, tired of attending yet another lecture, organizing yet another discussion group online. We want more. A few weeks ago, I was preparing for a speaking trip to Oregon. The organizers told me, "These people don't need to be told what the problems are. They don't even need to be told what the solutions are. They already know that, and many of them are already in action. What they want is to take their activism to the next level." To do that, to fully step into one's mission here on Earth, one must experience an inner shift that cannot be merely willed upon oneself. It does not normally happen through the gathering or receiving of information, but through various kinds of experiences that reach deep into our unconscious minds. Whenever I am blessed with such an experience, I get the sense that some benevolent yet pitiless power, the shaman in the story, has reached across the void to quicken me, to reorganize my DNA, to rewire my nervous system. I come away changed. One way it happens is through the gathering of the tribe I described in this story. I think many people who attended the recent Reality Sandwich retreat in Utah experienced something like this. Such gatherings are happening now all over the world. You go back perhaps to real life afterwards, but no longer it seems real, so real. Your perceptions and priorities change. New possibilities emerge. Instead of feeling stuck in your routine, life changes around you at a vertiginous pace. The unthinkable becomes common sense and the impossible becomes easy. It may not happen right away, but once the internal shift has occurred, it is inevitable. Here I am, a speaker and a writer, going on about how the time for mere talk has ended. Yet not all words are mere talk. A spirit can ride the vehicle of words, a spirit that is larger than, yet not separate from their meaning. Sometimes I find that when I bow into service, that spirit inhabits the space in which I speak and affects all present. A sacredness infuses our conversations and the nonverbal experiences that are becoming part of my events. In the absence of that sacredness, I feel like a smartass, up there entertaining people and telling them information they could just as easily read online. Last Friday night I spoke on a panel in New York, one of the three smartasses, and I think many in the audience left disappointed, though maybe not as disappointed as I was in myself. We are looking for something more, and it is finding us. The revolutionary spark of our true mission has been fanned into flames before, only to return again an ember. You remember an acid trip in 1975, a Grateful Dead concert in 1982, a Kundalini awakening in 1999, an event that in the midst of it you knew was real, a privileged glimpse into a future that can actually manifest then later as its reality faded into memory, and the internal routines of life consumed you. You perhaps dismissed it and all such experiences as an excursion from life, a mere trip. But something in you knows it was real, realer than the routines of normalcy. And with that, we're going to make a segue transition to the next sequence.
Your mic is not on. Good afternoon. We have Charles Eisenstein on the phone, and if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tickling the Belly of the Beast from the heartland of Santa Cruz on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM. And Charles Eisenstein is the author of The Ascent of Humanity, The Age of Separation, The Age of Reunion, and The Convergence of Forces, Crises, that is birthing the transition It's about the history and future of civilization and the evolution of the human self. And he has a website called The Ascent of Humanity, as well as Reality Sandwich. And that reading was from Reality Sandwich. And I'm going to make sure we have him on now. Charles, are you with us?
Hello.
Hi. Welcome.
Thank you.
You came on about a month ago, too. We so enjoyed having you on. We want to have you back.
It's good to be back.
Thank you. Well, we just read A Gathering of the Tribe from Reality Sandwich, and just want to ask you how that came to you. That story, it's beautiful.
It kind of, it just kind of appeared in complete form. And I think that true stories are something that are given to us mm-hmm. in a way like we don't really create them. And this one, in fact, I think ancient storytellers were also, they also saw their stories as something that they had been given. And like, I don't feel like I made it up, and I feel like it feels true to me. You know, it's mm-hmm. a true story, which is different from it being a factual story. Although I suppose you could easily articulate a metaphysics in which it were both factual and true.
And what's so beautiful is so many of us have felt that despair and feel like we don't necessarily belong here. In our hearts, we know there's a more beautiful way of living.
Mm-hmm.
And in your book, yeah. you write so well about that, and it's as a practical orientation as well. You address that despair.
I think we all feel that, and I mean by all, I mean like all of humanity. And it's just that some people suppress it better than others.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that, you know, one reason why teenagers are so rebellious is that, and suffer from, well, not just teenagers, but why people in general, but especially teenagers, suffer from depression, anxiety, attention deficit problems, is that on some level they're rebelling against this world that has been handed to us and offered to us as normal. And they're refusing to participate on some level. And it could take the form of an addiction or like procrastination and laziness, you know. And all of these are ways of rebelling. Because on some level we all sense that, you know, things are not supposed to be like this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you, Charles, this is Thomas. And
he's my co-host.
And
hi.
Hello. You then talk about in your book the age of reunion, that mm-hmm. that takes us past that point of despondency or despair or alienation that I experienced so much when I hit that cusp point between teenager and adult. And mm-hmm. I really hope for young folks not to get lost in that morass. So I'm really interested to hear what you got about the age of reunion.
Yeah, it took me decades mm-hmm. to begin living in the age of reunion, and it's taking the human race centuries collectively to move into it. I'm meeting young people, though, mm-hmm. since you mentioned young people. I'm meeting young people who have gone through the process that took me a couple decades in just a couple years,
mm-hmm.
And in a way, people of our generation have processed it on behalf of them and created, you could say we've created a map or we've just an energetic template for transition through this territory of despair so that they still have to go through it. Mm-hmm. Although now I'm also meeting some that never even have to go there.
Mm-hmm.
But if they do go through it, they go through it in a much quicker amount of time. Partly because, I mean, we've already, you know, created that morphogenetic field. You know, we've created that template,
yeah.
And also, in a very concrete way, you know, they read stuff that I've written and that other people who have passed, who have made this passage have written. So I think that the age of reunion is dawning for more and more people. And when it reaches a critical mass, it will happen collectively too.
And how do you characterize the age of reunion?
Well, it's living from a different story of self and a different story of the world. You could also say from a different story of the people. All cultures had a story of the self and a story of the people that defined what it is to be human, and what the purpose of a human being is on Earth and what the purpose of life is, and gave them a context or a framework to by which to understand the world and understand life. A story, by story, I mean a narrative that defines, that assigns meanings to things and assigns roles to human beings and coordinates human activity and tells us what's real and what's, you know, the way things are. And so the old story, I call it the story of the discrete and separate self, alone in a universe of other that's governed by force and mass, and in which more for me is less for you. We're in endless competition, and nothing matters. And the new story, and another part of the old story, which is deeply related to this, is the story of human ascent, by which we start out at the mercy of nature, superstitious and ignorant and helpless, and thanks to technology and culture and science, we rise above that primitive state to become the lords and masters of nature, which was Descartes' phrase. And it's no coincidence that Descartes also, you know, articulated the separate self, you know, the mote of consciousness inside a prison of flesh. And so that's the old story.
And that's the one we're living in.
And we're living in the world that's based on that old story, that comes from that old story. And part of that story is this alienation and helplessness and powerlessness. So the new story is the connected self, living in co-creative partnership with the earth. And from this new story, this is kind of like the overarching meta-story. And hold on, I've got to get the door. Hold
sure.
on.
Sure. We're speaking with Charles Eisenstein, and he's sharing with us the transition.
Hey. Okay, sorry about that. life intrudes
oh,
on
for
the
sure.
virtual world of the radio.
It's real life.
So, yeah, the new story then, the connected self, right, and so this is the overarching meta story, and it generates many, many stories that define the world and that define our actions. And you see, what's been happening, and I can give you some examples, like one is what I call living in the gift, seeing our lives as a gift, understanding our lives as a gift, and orienting ourselves toward what can I give rather than how can I make sure to make a living. And there's many of these other, like the stories that motivate holistic health, holistic healing. These are also part of the connected self in co-creative partnership with Earth. And so, what's happening today is that people are stepping out of the old story because it's not working anymore. The old story is essentially unsustainable.
Yeah.
And it's falling apart around our ears.
Well, yeah, we see it, the environment, the economy, and all of that stems from the illusion, according to your book, that we are living under that story. It's not sustainable.
Right. Yes.
It's fueling. It's fuel for its own destruction.
Right. And part of the old story is control.
Yes.
That because we're essentially fundamentally separate from nature in this story, we can insulate ourselves, at least in theory, we can insulate ourselves from the effects of our actions. So, for example,
that's a result of a story.
Right. That comes from a story. It comes from a story of separateness. So So if I dump toxic waste down a sinkhole, well, I'll just move away from there. It won't affect me. I can buy products that come from, you know, oppressed workers, and that's okay. You know, why should that affect me? I can insulate myself from those effects. Your health, your well-being, me. That's part of the old story. It's part of the story of separation. From the point of view of the connected self, and this isn't just an ideology. I mean, pretty much everybody would agree with the idea that we are connected and that you're, you know, that we're interdependent. But it's, what I'm talking about is an embodied belief, a living, present belief. From that story, it's obvious that what happens to the rainforest happens to me. And we can feel the truth of this. Mm-hmm. Anytime you're driving along and you see a forest being bulldozed,
yeah,
and you feel the sense of loss, as if something of your being was wounded, like, I mean, or you read about a species going extinct and you feel like that you yourself have been reduced thereby, that is the truth. And that's drawing us into the new story.
Mm-hmm.
That is so true. I remember when I lived in New England, I went to escape to my favorite place in the woods in New Hampshire, and there was a logging truck in front of me with a number of logs and my favorite trees, and the pain that I felt, that was the first time I recognized that, because they were my solace.
Yep.
It's so true. And I didn't put it together with our whole culture and what was happening, but that pain, it surprised me at how sharp it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And from within the old story, we say, well, that's irrational.
Yes, and that's what I thought.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, but so then what's happening is, you know, the old story's falling apart. We're moving out of the old story. But the new story hasn't been fully articulated yet. And so when we have these feelings, we can't make sense of them. And really what I see my work, one way I see my work is as
yeah.
a storyteller of the new world.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many of us telling the story of the new world.
One of the aspects of the new world that I find intriguing, it loops back to something you said earlier about the getting my pile, or there's more for me means less for you.
Mm-hmm.
And in the new story, what I'm getting from what you're saying is that in the new story, what's the one thing that is inexhaustible? It's social capital. It's how many friends one has, or what the social network. That's something that each one of us
yes.
can build and not take anything from anybody. Actually, by building our social networks, we're giving to each other.
Or right. More for you is more for me.
More for you is more for me. Exactly. A yep. win-win thing. And
yep.
And that's not just from... That is one of the things that your shaman story, there's a book called The Shawnees and the War for America, and they talk about the aspect of what's rich in Shawnee culture was your social capital. It wasn't how much stuff you had. And
yep.
when I read that,
yeah.
I realized that, oh, that's who I am. I'm one of those. That energy never disappeared. So it was like just like your story, which I hadn't read
I
until
know.
Today. Very nice story. I love your the meta story is what you're talking
yeah.
about in the age of reunion. So keep mm-hmm. tell us more.
Well, I'm thinking about your Shawnee
mm-hmm.
Story there, and this was pretty much universally true. When I read, like say Icelandic sagas or old literature, there's always a lot, or even like the Iliad, you know. There's a lot of stuff on who gave what gifts to whom. And because all cultures were gift cultures back then. In a gift culture, it's just like you said, the wealth does not come from accumulation. It comes from flow. It comes from,
mm-hmm.
you know, how many people are in a state of gratitude toward you because you gave them gifts. And the wealthiest person is the one through whom the most gifts flow.
Mm-hmm.
So like in a potlatch society where the greatest status went to the person who gave the biggest party and gave away the most stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And this was, I read also an ethnography of the Kung in the Kalahari Desert. And
ah.
I am circling back to your question here. But
no, go.
Just,
yeah.
Yeah.
It's good.
So
it is.
The anthropologist asked his informant, he said, well, there's a word for wealth called kai, and a wealthy man would be a kaiha. So he said, and kai means like beads and, you know, other valuables, like, you know, pretty stuff. And so he said to Zoma, which was the informant's name, he said, what makes a man a kaiha? Is it because he has much kai in his hut, stored in his hut? And Zoma said, no. We would not call someone a kaiha for having a lot of kai. We would call someone a kaiha when he makes a lot of kai flow.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, and then the anthropologist said, he seemed to be saying that wealth is a matter of how many friends you have,
mm-hmm.
not how much stuff you have. So that completely backs up what you were saying. And so, it's something that we can actually live right now, even mm-hmm. though the money system that we're a part of, we have to swim against the money system
mm-hmm.
that we know today, and swim against the attitudes that are built into that money system in order to live in the gift. But nonetheless, in some magical way, when we do that, things work out, except when they don't. But part of the Age of Reunion that I'm investigating, and I'm writing a book now that I'm calling Sacred Economics, is to think about, okay, what kind of money system would actually embody the principles of a gift, so that it creates abundance instead of scarcity, that it creates a flow of that meets all needs instead of polarization of wealth, that doesn't demand endless growth, and, you know, a sacred economy.
Mm-hmm.
One that doesn't, as you talked about the last time, include interest and debt.
Right.
Along with it.
Yes.
Kind of just sustaining.
Right. So, yeah, I guess I talked about that last time, but that's part of the Age of Reunion. That would be like the economics of reunion. And then I also, you know, talk about the medicine of reunion, the education of reunion, the science of reunion, the technology of reunion. All of these are embedded in these meta stories.
When you spoke about you mentioned the education of reunion. My daughter attends Waldorf School, and the one of the ideals behind Waldorf education is holding space for the child to discover what their gift is.
Right.
Instead of training for some vocation, which can be acquired after one realizes what one's gift is, and then it's living from the heart, which is where the flow of energy comes from for a vibrant human life instead of a drudgery.
Yes. And so holding space for the child to discover her gift, that is squarely in the new story, because basically it's trusting nature. It's a mm-hmm. co-creation. Whereas conventional schooling today is still a matter of training the child to overcome her natural desires.
Mm-hmm.
And to develop good work habits and to do work that, you know, maybe she'd rather be doing something else right now, but you have to suppress those desires. And you can't just do whatever you want. You know, you have your work to do, and maybe after your work is done and you've done all your homework, then you can do what you want to. But, you know, because education, schooling as we know it, was developed during the Industrial Revolution because people just didn't want to stand in a factory and do dull, trivial, humiliating work hour after hour after hour for an external reward. So school basically trains people to do trivial, even sometimes humiliating work for an external reward.
I often felt that way in school when I went from Quaker school to the traditional public school.
It's interesting that a lot of those factory jobs we no longer have in our country. So it's almost as if the economic situation or the job market was contributing toward having to find a new path.
Yeah.
Right. Although, even so, many jobs, maybe most jobs, are not things people would do if they weren't paid to do them.
I know. Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, still doing it for an external reward.
Mm-hmm. And you write...
Even if it's a challenging job that requires, you know, some independent thought and creativity, you know, like, I mean, if your job is to maximize the market share of Colgate over Crest or whatever toothpaste there are today, like, you know, do you really care about that?
I know.
Like, in your heart? Probably not.
No. In all honesty, I don't think anyone could, possibly. But you write about feeling from your desires. Maybe initially the desire might be to make $1 million, so they'll start in that profession, and then discover there's no satisfaction. There's something, there's still a gaping hole in their heart somewhere. And you recommend just continually following their desire can lead to despair, given the options available in our world view that we're born into.
Yeah, you know, I definitely, I'm always very careful not to send a message that's kind of alarming and judgmental, that says, hey, you know, you're destroying the planet with your lifestyle, and your job is, you know, meaningless, and you're just doing it for the money and all that kind of stuff, because, like, that's all logic. And really, the revolution in human beingness that I feel that I'm a part of goes a lot deeper than finding another new standard of good and trying really hard to be good.
And there's the key, trying. I hear it.
Right. It's a deep self-trust that says, you know, maybe like you recognize that your job is not contributing to the more beautiful world that your heart desires. But, you know, maybe you're just afraid to leave it right now, and maybe it just doesn't feel right to leave it right now, and you can come up with all these reasons why you can't or why you shouldn't. And that's okay. So the self-trust says, you know, when the time comes for me to leave this job, I will trust myself just as I trust myself now to stay in it. The old story must end before the new story begins. And this is kind of, it's like a birth process, you know, where you go through, in any job or even a relationship, you know, you go through a time of uterine bliss where it's a great job, you're excited to do it, you're growing as a person within it. And then what was once so commodious and nurturing becomes confining. The same job, but now it's confining because you've grown up against its limits. And that sense of confinement and being stuck and being stifled and, you know, I hate it here, but I can't see any way out. And this is the despair we're talking about. And this has been the state of humanity for a long time. This reaches, it intensifies and it intensifies until you're in a situation called, you could call it hell.
In
a situation that is intolerable, but that you have no choice but to tolerate. And that's the point where birth is triggered. And, you know, we enter the next stage where the cervix opens and we see a light. We see a beacon. We see that there is something to move toward. There is a way out. And it's a very arduous journey, perhaps, to get there. But we're not doing, you know, we don't do most of the work as we're being born. We are propelled into this new world. And so I think that, you know, we all go through this process, and if you're, and it really can't be rushed. So humanity, I think, is now also going through this process where the despair is giving way to more of a an energized hero's journey, where we, you know, we know what we're striving for. There's people now who are just, you know, already who are dedicated. They dedicate their lives, their heart and soul toward creating, toward reaching this light. And this soon, humanity as a whole will shift toward that, where we we kind of get a sense of ourselves and why we're here. And the first phase of it will be the healing of the planet. That will be, I think, the collective human intention.
To heal.
The light towards which we progress, you know, for maybe a couple centuries.
Yes. And you talk about that in that despair just before you begin to realize that there is something more than your own reality, that it could possibly be illusion. A lot of people get involved in distractions and addictions. And that, does that impede the process?
Addictions, distractions. It's funny you say, talk about addictions and distractions right now. There's,
well, it could be television or...
really loud noise going on upstairs.
Here. Oh, I hear that.
Hold on. Yeah, hold on a sec. Let me just...
Sure. Hey,
Mike, can you go up and tell them to stop rolling stuff on the floor?
That's live radio for you, folks.
I know.
Yeah.
We were having that same problem here before the show started. There was a jackhammer.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Distractions.
But
yeah. Okay, so let's can you just
yes,
you were that for me again?
Talking about distractions and addictions as preventing the possibility of reaching the next level or as another awareness where you can begin to feel hopeful and see the world differently.
I would put in that what needs to happen, not necessarily needs to happen, but it's complete acceptance of what is. And then what do I want to do next? It's not looking out at the world thinking that this is wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong, and it needs to be fixed. It's like, this is how it is, and what do I want to do about it? And your line in this myth story, a peaceful and exuberant humanity living in co-creative partnership with a wild garden earth.
Mm-hmm.
That's
beautiful.
That's what's possible for us, isn't it?
Yep, that's what our future is. It's going to take a long time to fully manifest that future. But even in our lifetimes, we're going to experience a world that's far more beautiful than the one we live in today, and far more hopeful. I mean, we're going to all have a really strong sense that we're moving in the right direction. Today, there's a lot that's happening in the world that would, you know, lead people to believe that we're not moving in the right direction, that things are going to get worse and worse, and that we're doomed. And in fact, they've got a point.
Mm-hmm.
From within the old story, which defines what's real and possible, we are in fact doomed. It is going to take a miracle to save our species.
If we stick with the old story.
Well, I see a miracle as being something that's impossible from an old story and possible from within a new story.
Got it.
So it's not like, you know, the intercession of an external divine agency that violates the laws of material reality.
Yeah.
It's something, I mean, you know, an electrical freezer is a miracle to a Stone Age hunter-gatherer. You know, it's something that just cannot exist from within their story of the world.
Mm-hmm.
But to us, it's not a miracle, because our story of the world says that that's totally possible. It says, here's why it works.
Hmm.
And we also have stories about what's possible, stories that define what's possible and what's real, both in the technological realm and in the social realm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and basically we say, well, you know, this could never happen, that could never happen. It would take a miracle for that to happen. It would take a miracle for the British to leave India without firing a shot.
Gandhi.
That was a miracle. And so it's obvious that we need miracles. You know, even like the current proposals that are on the table in the United States to reduce CO2 emissions or something. I mean, these are way too little, way too late.
Yeah.
And these are not even being accepted. Like, even the most radical proposals that are on the table are not enough.
Mm-hmm.
What we need is something that's not even on the table.
Yeah.
You know, like things like Paul Hawken advocates, you know, like a 300% carbon tax or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what we need is not even remotely acceptable in the political discourse. So it does take a miracle. And so that's why I've become very interested in how to create miracles.
In calling them such.
And the miracle could be that cultural shift from more for me, less for you, to more for everyone by social network and friendship and compassion for one another.
Mm-hmm. And once you start living in the new story, you become capable of things that are miraculous. They won't seem miraculous to you, just like a freezer doesn't. But to people in the old story, it will seem miraculous. Part of the story of despair, basically it says, well, there's nothing I can do about it. There's nothing I can do to save this planet because, you know, even if I recycle all of my stuff and ride my bike and have a low ecological footprint and vote for the right candidates and march in the streets and do everything, I'm just one person. And how can I, with the small amount of mass and force at my disposal, how
even,
can I even slow the juggernaut of destruction?
Converting
all that is good and beautiful into money. You know, what about the Bilderberg Council and the Trilateral Commission and the IMF and the, you know, cabal of bankers that control everything and the military-industrial complex and the pharmaceutical companies with their billions of dollars and who have all the world governments in their under their control? Like, how can I do anything with these powers arrayed against me? It's impossible. I'm just one person. But that despair, you see, comes from this sense of self as being separate, living in an objective universe that's separate from ourselves, so that what happens inside of ourselves doesn't affect the larger reality.
And the words you are using, I'll do this, I'll try this, I'll ride my bike instead of take my car as an example, it's still that doing instead of just having a natural desire for exercise
right.
or riding a bike. There's a whole way
right.
of thinking and that you write about language. There's so much you write about that's involved in this paradigm. And the voice is what we're using as opposed to language, and how even our language forces us to think in a certain way and therefore act in a certain way that's limiting to this new birthing.
Yes, the language itself is limiting because the language is tightly woven into the story of separation. Many of the ways that we speak reinforce the very things that we want to change. Like when we say of protecting the environment, you know, when we say protecting the environment, that's
mother.
It assumes that there's an environment that's separate from us.
Mm-hmm.
When we say, and just a lot of habitual ways of speaking, like when we say something like, you know, it would have been really easy for me just to, you know, throw my apple core in the trash can, but I took it home and buried it in my compost pile. That was the hard thing to do. It was the inconvenient thing to do. That required mindfulness, and I didn't just do the easy thing. Okay, and so basically that way of speaking and thinking, where hard equals good and easy equals bad, I mean, that is one and the same as the mindset of conquering nature. And what people hear and what we ourselves hear when we think along those lines is that, you know, you're bad.
Mm-hmm.
Nature, your natural self is bad, and we need to rely on this overlay of the mind and of the will, which and of trying hard to be good. And so it's a war against the self when we think that way. And the war against the self is the interior reflection of the war against nature. And when you try to control people like this and appeal to guilt and shame, you know, and you're going to have to try harder to live sustainably. What's wrong with you? You should feel guilty. You're bad. even if you don't say it that explicitly, when you carry that attitude, it's actually counterproductive.
Mm-hmm. So how do you encourage people from that despair of all that litany of what, you know, separates us into actually living in the new paradigm, into the age of reunion?
Well,
it's all an inside job is what I'm hearing you say.
No.
No?
No, it's not an inside job. What you do is you live from the new story. And from living from the new story, well, on one level, you know what to say and when to say it to people. But it's not just saying, it's also doing. When you live from the new story, say, like living in the gift, then you start doing things that just don't fit into the old story. You become a living exception to people's story of what is true and what happens in the way and how the world works. Just to like give like a really tiny example, you know that thing where you pay the toll for the person behind you?
Yes.
You know, like then you drive off and the person, like that just does not compute. Like why would somebody do that? It just doesn't fit in to the story of the separate self.
But it feels good.
Yeah. And then when you do bigger things, you know, and carry that story within you and really live it from full belief and not just as an opinion or something that you're striving for, but when you embody it, then you draw other people into it too.
Hmm.
And it could be because everybody, well, not everybody, I mean, people, like I said, need to finish the old story before they're ready to step into the new. But what you can do by living in the new story, acting from it, speaking from it, is you can invite people who are ready, who are done with the old story but don't know that there's a new story. You can invite mm-hmm. them into it. Partly because miracles will happen around you, and a miracle is essentially an invitation from the old story into the new. I hope I'm not being too abstract here.
You're not being too abstract, and it is a bit abstract. One of the ways that I think about it is even, no matter how big of a pile of stuff I have when I die, I can't even take one hair on my head along with me when I go. So what is it? What am I doing here? Am I here to gather a big pile of stuff that I can't even take with me when I die, which is inevitable for each and every one of us? Or am I here perhaps to connect with other people and help make things better and be measured by what I give away rather than what I acquire? I think that's maybe a concrete way of thinking about these abstractions of what can I give? What
and then
can
from
I
there
give?
Getting to the grander vision.
And the grander vision is of the co-creative and exuberant humanity living with a wild garden earth.
Yes.
Yeah.
But seeing it and living it.
The transition from knowing in our hearts that such a world is possible
mm-hmm.
to actually believing it.
Mm-hmm.
Requires traversing some territory. Another one of my jobs on this earth is to help people believe what they already know.
Mm-hmm.
When you actually believe something, then your actions will accord to your beliefs. That's why a lot of, like, you know, the secret kind of stuff, positive thinking doesn't really work. Just because you repeat something to yourself in your head or agree with it doesn't mean you actually believe it. When you act from a true belief in the story that you just said, the connected self living in co-creative partnership with Mother Earth, then you draw other people into it because, like, I'm kind of repeating myself, because what you do just doesn't make sense from within the story of the separate self. Mm-hmm. And even if you don't like go out of your way to make a big show of mm-hmm. your charity, mm-hmm. it is communicated no matter what. You don't have to worry about, you know, how visible it is. But living in that way gives other people the courage to do it too. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. You know, when I mean, there you might be, you know, afraid to take the next step in giving of your gifts toward this purpose. And then you see somebody, a magnificent person, who does make some, what looks to you like some great sacrifice, for a beautiful cause. And then you're inspired too, you know. The generosity of other people calls to us because that's what we want too. We want to live like that too.
It's not just a sense of feeling good, it's a sense of connection. And I think that's basically what we all long for.
So the gift could be something as simple and profound as simply saying hello to the people that you see during the course of your day, getting to know your neighbors.
And having them respond with that same warmth instead of just rushing out the door. And
yeah. The one gift that we can always give, and which in a sense, on a deep level, is our only gift, is the gift of attention.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And so, like when you're buying something at a store, instead of, you know, mechanically going through the ritual of making a purchase, you can really look at the person, really hear them. And when you do that, and you give the gift of attention, like people can feel it. It feels really good because we need attention because we are connected selves. And receiving attention gives us a respite from this isolation that we've created through our ideology of the separate self. And so people feel it. And when you do that, then all kinds of information comes. And you'll just know what to say or what not to say.
Yeah.
Healing happens through attention. And so that's, you know, I mean, I guess you could say it's kind of a baby step, you know, to start saying, not just saying hello to your neighbors, but it's really meaning it.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah, and I mean, that's a step, but you know, when you follow that path, soon you'll find yourself, you know, sharing your home with somebody who needs a home, you know, or, you know, giving away, like, all of your money or most of your money mm-hmm. to create something beautiful in the world that you want to create. You will no longer be afraid. When you're living in the gift, you know, you feel. Mm-hmm. It's not like you have to make a noble sacrifice in order to be good, but you actually live in the knowledge that, I'll be taken care of. And that knowledge is so deep that it extends to, I'll be taken care of even if I'm not.
There seems to be in this world a sense of expansion. Expansion in terms of possibilities and a freeing up in our, well, for me, just from listening to what you're saying, in the mind of different possibilities. There's an energy exchange. How do I say it? I'm lacking for words at the moment. Mm-hmm. But there's a freer flow of being.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so much being appropriate in the moment, it's just what feels in my heart at each moment, living in that state when I have. I mean, it goes back and forth for me. For me, it's going on vacation and feeling that sense of freedom. But then again, that's a segment. That's a separation, mm-hmm. vacation versus work. You know, I'm more aware now, since reading and talking with you, of the ways in which I still encourage the old way of being. It's almost cellular. And then I get glimpses of something else when I'm touching my cat or listening to the deep purr and the resonance, and there's no communication verbally, but there's a lot in the silence.
Yes.
Listening to the wind and a storm outside. It's like, this is it.
And the contemplation of that truth that you were talking about, the difference between belief and actually living something. And the belief or the reality that anyone can see that we are not separate entities, that we're intimately, how could we be here without everything else? How could we be here without the earth? But to contemplate or think on that until actually one can feel connected with the universe, with Mother Earth, with all the other people on the planet. And that
the exquisite beauty in that, and from the sunset, but all of it has an inherent beauty when I've tapped into that.
And we're all going to the same place, you know, the same place being the demise of our human existence, that we have this brief window of time to interact with each other. So let's get it on and interact.
I would like to address people who might be listening and thinking right now, like, well, that sounds great. I would sure like to have this embodied belief, this felt experience of connection. But what if I just don't? What if I'm just in this old story and I can't get out of it, and I just, to be honest, I just don't believe that I'll be taken care of, and I just am afraid to live in the gift. Like, what should I do? That's, when people are really honest, that's a question that comes up quite often. And the answer is that there isn't anything that you should do. The answer is that what you desire, what you seek, is happening to you right now. Perhaps even listening to me or coming across some other book or some other person, you'll experience a shift. This is not something that we can do by ourselves, this transition. The old spiritual truth of all the answers are within you, everything you need is within you, is no longer true. The new spiritual truth is the truth of interdependency, spiritual interdependency, which is, in other words, I need you. I need other people to bring me into this new story and to hold me there. We hold each other in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so at certain points, you'll receive an attunement. I guess you could say an attunement, or something will crystallize within you that is, in fact, a gift from the outside. It's not something that you can achieve by trying.
Mm-hmm.
The whole mentality of trying is useful for some things in this world, but not for this. It's kind of like, I give this whole map of this process called the invisible path. And it's a seven-stage path, and one of the stages there's stages of this search and this despair, you know, and you're searching and searching and trying really hard to find something. And at some point, this thing that you're trying to find, you give up, and then it finds you.
Mm.
It's like in the Matrix movie, you know, where it's actually a really good parallel to it, because Neo, he's searching for something, searching, searching, searching. That's how the movie opens, you know, searching, searching as a computer screen. And what he's trying to find, he cannot find with the tools that he's using to search it, because everything he does is still within the Matrix. And what he's looking for is something that contains the Matrix, it's outside the Matrix, it's bigger than the Matrix. So he cannot find it through searching, yet his search alerts Morpheus to his presence and to his desire. And so he comes in. When he finally meets Morpheus, Morpheus says, "You've been searching for me for a long time. I've been searching for you my whole life, and you know, now I've found you." And so this transition to the new story on an embodied level is something that happens to us. And so I would like to speak to people, you know, just speak to that angst and say it's happening to you, and tune into that knowing within you that resonates with the truth of what I'm saying. It is happening to you.
That despair. So to go deeper into that surrender, that acceptance.
you're almost turning it into a thing you have to do. You know, okay,
yes.
So to make this happen, you have to go deeper into the despair.
Just
and I'm saying you're already doing exactly what you need to do.
That's a note of encouragement. And can you say those seven steps on that? What was that, the individual path?
The invisible path.
Invisible path.
Invisible.
Invisible.
Because the territory that we're venturing into now has no map.
Mm.
You know, there's a map if you want to become a lawyer or a doctor or a success in the old story. The old story has many maps to do whatever you want, that's as long as it's contained within the old story. But, like, you know, humanity's at a transition point now.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no map. So we have to kind of feel our way, you know, through the new territory and just try out all these paths. And some of them are dead ends, or they lead to a swamp and we have to turn back. And yeah, the whole seven stages, it would probably take about half an hour for me to really go through it. There's an essay online.
We have to have you back again.
Where is the essay online?
It's on Reality Sandwich somewhere. If you just Google my name and Invisible Path, you'll definitely find it.
In Reality Sandwich.
Yeah.
And what do you, when you look at someone who's whole or who's living there, what's been met in their lives? Like what needs? Or would you even answer it that way?
Like
the need for love.
They experience authenticity and community. And wake up almost every day happy and excited to live the day.
I attend a number of different Indigenous ceremonies, and I find that afterwards I have a greater sense of self and understanding and connection. I'm not sure what, it's a lot of love and some ritual. And it's usually out in nature, very much aware of the elements.
Mm-hmm.
And that sustains me sometimes for only so long. But that's a community, and each time I go back, it's lasting longer and longer.
Yeah.
And that's a trust that that's what happens there. And then that trust tends to flow into my life more and more frequently.
Yeah.
But I need that community.
Yes, that's a good, you know, illustration of what I was saying, you know, that this is something that only happens together. I've been leading retreats and gatherings, I guess you could call them, ideally of between 20 and 30 people, you know, over a space of days where we can really come to know each other. And the purpose of these is to hold each other in the space of the new story in a sustained way so that this new thing has a chance to crystallize inside of us. And then we go forth from that, and the old normal just doesn't seem so normal anymore. And
very true.
The new normal begins to coalesce around us.
Charles, on your website, and that is the Ascent of Humanity, is that the way? And then so you would do a Google search. Do you
ascentofhumanity.com.
Do you have a listing of these gatherings?
I've gotten like so busy recently that I just don't even keep up with things, but there's one coming up in New York this weekend. And then after that, I'm going to take a couple months off to finish my book.
Great.
And then there's just kind of, like, things have been changing so fast that I haven't been, like, things like these events just kind of emerge spontaneously.
Mm-hmm.
But I plan to do a bunch of them next year.
Great.
Very cool. So, I have to throw this in, the invisible path. Here's what I heard. Search, despair, surrender, thing desired comes. And I'm going to read it online, too.
The progression is idealism, rebellion, search, despair, the glimpse, the invisible path, and arrival.
Wow.
Very good.
Brilliant. Well, we're going to have to end here. And I want to thank you for coming on again, Charles, and sharing so much of what you've gathered. I want to ask you, I know we don't have time, but some point how you came to gather all of this and to see so deeply into our condition and then transforming it so clearly.
Yeah, we didn't get to that, did we?
No, and I wanted, there's a lot we didn't get to. I kind of got lost in where we were, but we brought a lot in that I wanted to delve into.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was good. Yeah, you're welcome.
So maybe in another month or two. And I would love to work something out where we can bring you to Santa Cruz.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to be out in California again. I mean, that's on the agenda to do another event or two in California.
Will that be in the spring, do you think? Or?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I guess.
Great.
Yeah, maybe February or spring, or I don't know. Somewhere around there. Yeah.
Maybe we can have you in here live. Well,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And thank you so much.
Have fun in New York.
Thanks.
Yes.
Bye.
All right. Bye-bye. That was Charles Eisenstein, the
assassin. Please enter the number you wish to dial.
Whoops. This always happens. There. And we're going to be talking with Frank Durrell, who is the publisher of Addicted to War. And he's an individual that has really followed his heart. And as one person has made a tremendous difference in what he's doing. And I'll get him on the phone. And in the meantime, Charles is going to play
Thomas.
Some music.
Thomas. Last time
Charles is gone.
Last time I was on the radio with you, you changed me to Thomas Moore.
Thomas Moore. I remember
that. You changed
that.
Me to Charles. And I like that. What Charles was saying brought to mind this song. And first we have to do the tuning ritual, and then I have to make sure that this earphone cord does not traipse across the strings. And we have our other guest on the line, and here we'll get to the words next time I play this song. We have a little bit of time here. Seems like lately I've been losing a lot of things that were dear to me. Eating, breathing, going through the motions. Got no real reason to stay alive, but I know there's really no place else to go. Yes, and I feel there must be magic somewhere still, though I've tried. My running could not hide me. Yes, and I remember days of bright skies, early morning rising just to see what's new. And I know if I just
Keep on trying, good times are bound to come my way again. Thank you for lessons giving me to learn. Help me find my way along path of twists and turns. I know there's really no place else to go. Must be magic somewhere still. Yes, and I've tried. Oh, running could not hide me. Yes, and I remember days of bright skies, early morning rising just to see what's new.
Thank you very, very much. Beautiful. Well, we now have Frank Turrell, and he is the producer of the film. I'm getting it mixed up here. He published Addicted to War, and that is an amazing book, Why the U.S. Can't Kick Militarism. And it tackles the most active, powerful, and destructive military in the world. Ours, and it's fully illustrated. And he has a web page, and this is the name of his video, The War Against the Third World, What I've Learned About U.S. Foreign Policy. Also, you can go to that website and learn more about Addicted to War and the DVD. Right now, I'm going to put him on. Frank? Hi. Welcome to Tickling the Belly of the Beast.
Hi, Cindy. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. And with me co-hosting is Thomas Miller, so you'll hear another voice periodically.
Hello, Frank. Welcome to the airwaves.
Hi, Thomas. Nice to meet you.
Yes. Great. Well, thank you for coming on. And first thing I want to ask you is, how did you come to create the DVD? What was going on in your life and what motivated you? We were just talking to Charles Eisenstein about how we can really make a difference in our lives. Mm-hmm. From going from despair, being overwhelmed by the conditions and all the crises, and then one person starts to do something. And how was that for you?
Well, my awakening, into all this, and this peace action work, anti-war work, came about almost 30 years ago when I discovered KPFK in Los Angeles here, the Pacifica Network Station.
Yes.
And I was a driver for USC. I drove like 200 miles a day, and I discovered the station by myself, and I started listening to people like Noam Chomsky and Howard Zinn and a lot of these people that are on my video, and I didn't know these things. I didn't know, about U.S. foreign policy. I didn't know our country was doing so many bad things around the world. And I am a veteran. I got involved with Veterans for Peace, and I got involved in, going to events and things, And I bought videos and audio tapes of speakers and documentaries and stuff and books. And as time went on, I was trying to share them with people. And then as time went on, I came up with this idea that I can't give everybody all these things. I can't make copies of everything. But if I could kind of make the best of, put some of the best speakers and some of the best documentaries all on one tape, there was no DVDs back then, I might have something to give people. And so I procrastinated for 6 years, and then I finally did it. My first tape was 8 hours long, and it was called What I Learned About U.S. Foreign Policy. It had 17 segments. It was very crude. And after a year of that, I re-edited it down to 2 hours, and that was in 2000. And I think it's now, when I first made it, I was thinking of maybe 1,000 people could ever see it, I'd be happy. And I really think it's probably been seen by millions of people now. And I just took some of the best speakers that I've ever heard, and mm-hmm. the best documentaries, and I edited them together. I didn't film any of it, mm-hmm. but that's why the film is so good. I really took it from good sources, and I understand you were playing some of the segments on your show earlier.
Yes, Bill Agee and Brian Wilson and
Ramsey Clark. Right. All three great speakers, aren't they?
Amazing. And they each had a different understanding of what they'd experienced and what we're doing as a nation.
Right. And, of course, they all came from, Bill Agee came from being in the CIA, and Ramsey Clark was Attorney General of the United States, and Brian Wilson was in the Air Force, and he was a believer. He was a Republican, anti-communist, all-American guy who went over to Vietnam believing that he was doing the right thing. And all three of those people came to see differently as through their experience. And, Brian Wilson used to live in Santa Cruz.
He lived right here. In fact, Thomas knew him.
Yeah, Brian was my next-door neighbor for a little while.
Really?
Yeah. Well, actually, Brian's partner, Becky Looning, and hopefully they're listening at this point, but maybe they'll listen sometime in the future. Oh. And I used to live in Contra Costa County, where earlier in the show I said the weapons depot and shipping point was Point Richmond. It wasn't Point Richmond, it was Port Chicago, which is where that railroad line was. And Brian actually sat on the railroad track in front of one of the munition trains going to the shipping place on the Sacramento River.
Right.
And the train didn't stop.
Right. That was in 1987.
Right.
September 1st, 1987. Mm-hmm. I went up there a year ago on the 20th anniversary. I went up to where it happened. Brian was there, and a lot of the people that were there that day came. And Daniel Ellsberg came, and two of the other guys who were on the track with Brian.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a reunion. And Brian is just, Brian's just my favorite. He's just such a great human being, a great peace activist.
Mm-hmm.
Speaker, writer, a man who really walks his walk, and I'm really thrilled that he's the last segment on my video because he's such a great closing speaker. He talks about feeling in our hearts what to do, and he says he knows that we need a nonviolent revolution of consciousness, to change things.
Which is just what Charles Eisenstein was saying
in
slightly different words.
As our prayer gift.
And it's great that people like Brian and the other names you mentioned, Daniel Ellsberg, and are doing that lifetime work, because there's plenty of other people doing the other type of lifetime work of The Addicted to War, which is a brilliant little book that I'm so glad that you published it. I wish that it was required reading in every classroom in the country.
I believe it is in San Francisco.
Yeah, in San Francisco 2 years ago, they a woman, an activist, here's a good story, a woman, that was her name, Pat, I forget her last name now, she got the book, she read it, she was taken by it so much, she went to the Board of Supervisors, people from the Board of Education, there's a special committee that deals with books, she brought the book to them, and they read it, and they voted unanimously to make it official subjective reading book for the history teachers in San Francisco High School District.
Mm-hmm.
And I sent 4,000 books up there, and that was a pretty big deal. I got on, ABC did a new story on it, and Fox did a national story on it. And
Fox.
Not too often do we get on the mainstream.
Right.
What was their take on it?
What's that?
What was their take?
Well, the both of the people that did those shows were pretty neutral. They had in both shows, they used the same Republican right-wing guy to say the book has no facts in it. And then they interviewed one of the teacher who accepted the book in San Francisco saying, well, we think it does,
all validated.
But I got a lot of orders from those shows. I also got more hate email from that Fox show, which was national. And I didn't know they were doing it. It was going on live. And the next day, I woke up and I had more hate emails on my email in one day than I've had in all these years of doing this work.
Yeah.
But I also got over 100 orders from people that heard that show for the book.
There's the two sides of the coin, huh?
Right. Well, the thing is, I mean, you guys know this, and I'm sure your audience knows this, but it's so hard for us those of us that have learned this information, which is not what we were brought up to believe, not what we were taught in school when we were going to school, and not what our country is supposed to be about, what we're told, that our country is actually doing crimes all over the world and killing people and invading countries and for lies and all this, but the mainstream will not accept that, will not acknowledge that, will not own up to it. And the mainstream, the media, the mainstream, the government, The mainstream of the country won't do that. So I see our job and what you're doing on your show and what all of us in the peace movement are doing is trying to break through to people to reach them so they can, you know, kind of join with us in saying, no, we don't want to participate in you know, killing and maiming people all over the world for lies. It's not for self-defense. It's not for bringing democracy to people. And that's what I call the big lie. But it's a hard one because they own the mainstream media, and the propaganda is so thick that it's so many people won't even listen to what we're saying.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I think more people know about these things now than ever before. I really do.
Yeah, I believe you're right. And the other aspect that really is in people's consciousness is just the monetary reality of how much money is being spent on our military and how little is being spent in social programs. And as that gets huger and huger, the disparity, the
right.
difference between those two, it's going to get people's attention.
Yeah, and Phil
right.
Agee addresses.
Well, Joel Andreas really covers it pretty well in the book.
He does. Actually, by chapter, it starts with Manifest Destiny, which is what we've basically, as a very aggressive nature, have consumed and overpowered a lot of other nations, starting with the Native Americans here. And then he goes into the Cold War, the New World Order with Bush, the War on Terrorism, which is a perpetual war, then the War Profiteers. He covers so much. And then the price of militarism, the domestic programs that are suffering, and then militarism in the media, how so many corporations are owned, how much media is owned by the corporations and
right.
the Pentagon.
He's done such a fantastic job in the book. I've got a whole library of great books on this topic, you know, by Howard Zinn and Noam Chomsky and William Bloom and Michael Prenti and Ramsey Clark and everybody else. But none of them are as easy to read as Addicted to War is, which I read when I first got it the first time. I read it in one sitting.
I know.
And you laugh a little because it's got some funny parts in it. But his humor, I believe, is ironically true. I mean, it's not really sarcastic. He's not really making fun of soldiers or putting down the soldiers. He's bringing the light right to you, right in his book, which is actually a comic book. It's a illustrated expose. But it really has become one of the most popular books in the peace movement all over the country. Pretty much everybody in the peace movement embraces Addicted to War. And we are trying to get it into more and more schools. We have a program called the Addicted to War Books to School Program, which will allow high school teachers to get a class set of 30 for free. So if there's any high school teachers listening out there and you agree with the message of the book, you know, the anti-war message that we're talking about here, you know, you can contact me. We can get you a class set for free. And more and more teachers are taking it. You know, there's plenty of teachers out there that do agree with this message. And
there is some hope
because when I was growing up, a book like this would have never been in my high school. Come on, man.
Mm-hmm.
So my website, by the way, for anybody listening, it's addictedtowar.com. And all my information's on there. It's addictedtowar.com. My phone number and email is all in there. And you can actually read the book online on our website if somebody wants to read it first. But it's a very good idea to have the book, you know, and have it to give to people.
Mm-hmm.
As, instead of trying to convince people of these things yourself, to have the book or the video or whatever to offer to somebody if they're open to hear. So,
right. And
so Brian Wilson talked about that change of consciousness.
Yeah.
You know, the 100th monkey, that we're all working toward, and I think we have to keep doing it because what other choice is there? You know,
there isn't, and it feels good.
Well, it's all
coming,
and also it feels good, and it fits right in with what Charles Eisenstein was saying about that. That's part of the old story. The old story is that as a basic implement of our foreign policy is brute force.
Mm-hmm.
The new story is that we are all in this together, and diplomacy is the way to go. It's not brute force.
Right.
And I like how you ended the books. The next chapter, or not how I'm confusing how Joel ended the book, Andreas, of the next chapter. Do something about it. There's actually suggestions on what people can do to help bring about the news story, to bring about the change, and refocus our national interests.
And other organizations that are involved already that you can contact.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of contact numbers too. But he's
about 25 different organizations that are doing this work.
Yeah, and I want to right now say appreciate you for the work that you're doing and putting yourself out there and online and following your heart and getting, you know, both sides of that coin that you said after the Fox broadcast of getting hate emails and getting accolades.
Yeah. I don't normally get much of that, really. It's amazing how little of that I've received all these years. But then that, you know, when you're
on Fox.
but it was good in a way because, we were on the other side. We are trying to reach the other people. I believe most people are good. They don't want to do the wrong thing. They just believe something that's been taught to them that's really not accurate.
They've been
really
terribly misinformed.
Mm-hmm.
Misinformed, yeah. And they know how to do it. They tie it into patriotism and defending mm-hmm. ourselves from the evil. The other people are always evil.
Mm-hmm.
But of course they're not. They're just the same as we are everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody wants to be invaded. Nobody wants to have their, bombs dropping them and foreign soldiers in their country and with tanks shooting and breaking into their homes. And nobody wants that. And the amazing thing is that how this country has done this over and over again, time and time again, either directly or indirectly, secretly through covert operations and getting other people to do it. And yet, there's this image here that we are the good guys, and it's Orwellian, is all I can say.
Well, it starts at the inception of the country that Manifest Destiny and the genocide against the native people that are still here. It's not the idea that the native people are not here anymore is actually completely inaccurate. They just have kind of. The message that they have is still valid, and the message of honoring Mother Earth and honoring each other as beings is still a valid message and is still there to be tapped upon. But we started that way, and it's something I think that's like there's amnesia in our national psychology that we started by decimating a populated continent.
Right.
And that's not even written about in many textbooks, or it's lightly glossed over, and then there are excuses made for it. Well, we needed the land we needed the resources of the land. The people were inconvenient. They didn't share our values. But what I love about the book, too, Addicted to War, is the author, Joel, will write about the reasons that we hear in the media for going into war. And then next to that, he writes the real truth and the cartoons that he has. There's an example I was looking at here with the Bush administration when talking about Bin Laden's tapes, and we're being told this is what was really going on. The Bush administration immediately instructed U.S. television networks to exercise caution and airing Bin Laden's tape messages. The official reason? The tapes may contain secret coded messages for terrorist operatives. We knew darn well that it was going to expose the fact that there was vengeance on their part, justifiably so, because we'd been in the Mideast taking their resources and murdering them for years.
Yeah. Understandable. Well, I don't know if justifiable is what I understandable.
Understandable.
That,
yes.
That there's action reaction. If you push
one
against
of my favorite frames in the book is on page 22 here. Washington here the narration. Washington came to think of the oil fields in the Middle East as its own private reserve.
Oh yeah.
And the Arab man is saying he's asking the American oil man, "What are you up to?" And the American oil man says, "Exploring to see if there are any vital American interests under your soil." I mean, and that's kind of funny. But then right across from that is a quote from Henry Kissinger. All the quotes in the book are real.
They are.
Oil is much too important a commodity to be left in the hand of the Arabs.
Yep.
And that's one of the good things about the book. The quotes are all real. If there's any quotes around the words, they're real quotes from people throughout the history of this country. And everything in the book is pretty much documented, and there's 161 reference footnotes in the back where you can see where Joel has got all his information.
Somebody can disagree
with the information, but they can't disagree with the place where Joel got it from, because that's why it's in schools, high schools and colleges, because it's all documented. And it's really all true. It's just that, once again, this is the truth. It's a lot of Americans haven't been taught this, and they don't want to really, it's hard to believe. And that's our job, once again, I think, in the peace movement here, is trying to get people to see this. It is horrible to see, but on the other hand, it's really there's something good in seeing it, so because it won't change until more people see it. And that's the basic premise I worked on since I first made my video and gotten involved in the peace movement. It's basically that if people don't know about this, then how can they do anything to change it? So
yeah, and this is succinct. It's easily understood and read. And I want to ask you about your DVD. How did you select each segment?
Well, I had been buying, like, all these different video tapes over the years, and when I finally got over my procrastination, the night that really convinced me to do it, I was Ramsey Clark, the one on my video here. He was here in Los Angeles. It was 1998. He was speaking at a church right down the street from me, and I went to see Ramsey. There were about 500 people there that night, and he was between the two wars in Iraq, but they were talking about the sanctions at the time that were causing 5,000 children to die every month in Iraq, and Ramsey spoke that night, and I was so, and his talk, it was about a half hour, but I've got about eight minutes of it on my video, but I was so moved by him that night that I said, you know, I have to stop procrastinating from this. I have to start doing it. I didn't know what to do, but I just started in, and once I started in, it just happened, and I went through all these different films I had, and I just watched everything. I took notes, and I just started putting together the people in the documentaries I thought told the story the best, and, you know, edited them down, and it was kind of a process, but I'm pretty proud of it. It really is, as some people have said, it's kind of timeless, because I like to tell people who tell me how bad it was during the 8 years of Bush and Cheney, which they're true, it's true that it was bad, but I like to tell people I made my film before Bush Jr. was president, and you look at all the atrocities the United States has committed before he was ever president, and you start to realize this is nothing new. It's been happening all along. The difference with Bush and Cheney was that it was more obvious what they were doing and how bad it was. A lot of people in this country know the war in Iraq was wrong, but I don't know. People still call me to this day and tell me they've seen my film somewhere and it really changed their life somehow. And I always love hearing that, because that's exactly why I made it, to wake people up, you know. And for somebody who knows the things on the video, it's a good tool for them to give to others. You know, some people tell me, I know all this stuff, Frank. I say, yeah, but you can't probably convey it to someone else as good as the people on this video do. You know, there's some...
And
it
so
starts
many.
Off with Martin Luther King. It's an incredible opening with
that
Martin
speech.
Luther King speaking against the war in Vietnam.
It's riveting the whole way through. It really is.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, my computer crashed in the middle of it, so I had to go and buy another used one, and then I could finish seeing it.
There was something you just said about a lot of people knew that the war in Iraq was wrong, and I think that was a bit of a syntax slip, because it's still wrong, and it's still going on.
Of course. I didn't mean to say it. I didn't mean to say it. It's not still wrong. It's not still going on. The funny thing is that, but what's happening now is a lot of people think, because Obama's the president, a lot of people think it isn't going on, or it's not so bad anymore. You know, have you found that to be true? That's what I find.
Yes, I have, surprisingly enough.
I have found that to be true, and I also get questions from my daughter every now and again. Well, why are we still in Iraq, Dad? Why are we in Afghanistan?
Yeah.
And he's the president
what a great
of the
question.
Empire.
Yeah, it's a great question, and I know that transitions of any magnitude are difficult to manifest, and I can't really give her a good answer for that, except that...
How old's your daughter?
She's 12.
Oh, wow.
And
girl.
Yeah, except that we've stirred up the pot so much over there that... what is the answer to that question? Do you have an answer for that question? Why are we still there?
Because the United States is addicted to war. Because this is what the United States does. These aren't mistakes. This is what this country, the people that run this country, do. They go and make war on people, and they occupy them, and they stay there, and they take their resources, and they build bases, and they spend the money doing that while people are homeless here and people are don't have health care. And this is what this is all about. It's such a lie. That money they spent there, if they spent one tenth of that money, they could probably cure everything in this country. And they could probably repair those other countries, too, if they spent it peacefully. But it's not what they do, and it's really it's a hard message for people to get because it can't be. Our country wouldn't do that.
Well, that's what we're told. That's that we're fighting for democracy, fighting for freedom. Couldn't be further from the truth.
Right.
Sort of
learned the opposite.
Yeah, and it's
but the thing is that's so ironic is that there are a lot of good things happening here, and people point out to people on the other side will point out to me who are friends of mine but don't agree with what I'm doing will say to me, well, Frank, if it's so bad here, how come they let you do this here? How come they let you publish this book and put your video out and let you, you know, let all of us operate? And I said, well, first of all, I'm happy they do let me. I'm glad I'm not getting put in jail or being tortured, you know, but that doesn't make it okay that what our country does in these other countries. It just doesn't make it okay. And the thing is, we do support torture and those kind of things in other countries. It's just once again, it's Orwellian.
And to keep the whole system intact requires violence, because people are not going to live under conditions of such oppression and repression. Yeah. It's intolerable to the human spirit.
I can't imagine being living in Iraq or Afghanistan or been in Vietnam or any of these other countries that where we've been. And of course, the thing is, we're not the only country to ever do this. People point this out all the time. Of course, other countries have done these kind of things over the years. Yes, but that still doesn't make it okay that our country is doing it.
Exactly.
And now that we're the only superpower in the world, and I just think about people in other countries who live in this in these terrible conditions and who've had arms and legs lost or who are starving or who don't have a way of life, and it's our system that's imposing this on them. And that's the thing that those of us that understand are so upset about and trying to do something about it. And it is frustrating trying to get our friends and neighbors and families to join in with us because they don't all want to do that.
And they're still comfortable within that system. Things are changing rapidly. They're less comfortable. They're sort of being shaken up. But the economy is one of a military. Eisenhower warned about the military-industrial complex.
He was
so terrified.
He did. I wanted to, it's interesting you say that because I really wanted to get that clip and put it at the start of my video. I couldn't get it. I couldn't get a copy of it. But I really wanted to open my video with that.
Eisenhower
saying that
in
our office.
You couldn't get a copy of it because whoever owns rights to it wouldn't share it? Or
I tried. I didn't have a copy, and I asked around, and I couldn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually asked Oliver Stone. I don't know him personally, but I had a friend that worked with Oliver Stone, and I indirectly did stuff through my friend. Oliver Stone loved my film, so I asked my friend to ask him if we could get a copy of that, because in his movie, JFK, his movie opens, if you remember, it opens with that scene of Eisenhower on TV talking about the military complex, they'll let them take us over. And he just basically told my friend that he had no ability to give that to me,
And then John Stockwell, I think it was John, spoke about the beginning of the CIA and the National Security Agency.
Yes.
And Truman.
Stockwell and Phil H. are the two ex-CIA guys on my video.
Yes.
And they're both just brilliant speakers. Of course, Phil H. died about, a year and a half ago.
But, in Cuba.
Stockwell, the two of them I saw both in person a few times. Were just brilliant speakers who talked about what they did in the CIA and what the CIA was doing. And whenever I hear anybody in this country saying the CIA is inept or the CIA is doing something good, I just always cringe and go, I don't think so. Stockwell said that when he was running destabilization in Angola, and I think it was in 1976, and his he was a station chief, and he was working, his boss was George Bush Sr., Stockwell said he had, unlimited amounts of money and manpower at his disposal, and two-thirds of the money and the manpower were used for propaganda, used to misinform people. And they do it really well. They know how to do this.
They
put stories in newspapers. They put out false information everywhere, and people believe what they hear, and it works.
They don't want to believe that their father, the government, is creating all these atrocities, perpetuating them in their name.
Right.
It's easier to deny that.
Yeah.
But what I love about the DVD, too, is that you give everyone a context, a historical context, for the beginning of the CIA and how it grew and their operations, how they occur, why they're occurring, the details. And there's a segment on the Panama Deception as well. And I didn't know just how horrendous that invasion was, short-lived. Right. And this continues in Iraq and Afghanistan.
The Academy Award for the best documentary, I think, it won in 1992, is directed by Barbara Trent and David Casper. The other film on my, one of the other segments on my DVD is called Cover Up, Jihad Iran Contra Affair, which they also made. They are the Empowerment Project. And those two films are two of the best films, documentary films I've ever seen. Both of them are narrated by Elizabeth Montgomery, who played Samantha in Bewitched.
Yes.
You know, we all grew up watching, at least I did, you know, the Bewitched, the old show, and she was a good witch. And that really is very effective for a lot of people when they see the film and they realize that that's Elizabeth Montgomery narrating those two documentaries. And they're so well done. There's so much information in there that's they're just two of the best films. And Barbara Trent, to her credit, she allowed me to do this. I don't know what other Academy Award filmmaker would let someone else, you know,
borrow
20 minutes of her Academy Award winning film to put it in his own.
Borrow it so liberally.
Yeah, so, and even at, so where do we go from here? You've got the information here, and it's, where do we go from here? What do we do next? How do we change this?
Well, that's a good question. You know, I can only repeat what I've been doing, and still am doing, is trying to get more people to see it, and to understand, and once they feel it and own it, then people maybe want to do something about it. It's just not so easy, but that's what I do. There's people doing different things, you know. I know a lot of my friends got involved in supporting Obama, thinking he was going to make a change, and hopefully they're now starting to see that isn't what's happening. But
what I
don't know what else is going to change it if the people in this country don't wake up and stand up and say no. I don't know what's going to change things. I really don't, so... But I always try to encourage everybody and anybody in the movement to just keep doing what you're doing, like your radio show and all. There's so many groups out there. And there's so many people doing this work. Amy Goodman, of course, I think reaches more people than anybody in the alternative media every day. Democracy Now! And, of course, Amy Goodman is on
my
video.
Also, she has a segment talking about East Timor and the Indonesian invasion. And I just want to add that anyone that wants to get this video, and I highly, highly recommend it, can go to Frank Doral's website, and that's called addictedtowar.com. And his email address is fdorrell, D-O-R-R-E-L, at addictedtowar.com. And can we give out your phone number?
Yep.
Really?
My phone number, it's on the back of my video, and it's in the book. You know, it's right there.
310-838-8131. And you
when people call me or email me to order the book or video, and hopefully they'll take both, you know, I just, whether or not they pay me yet, I just send it to them. I always tell people, send me the money, but first of all, I don't ask for
you
much
give
money
so
away.
Many away, too, because you give a lot away.
Oh, I've given away thousands, of course.
You do.
Because it's not a business for me. The money is helps in so I can order more books and videos, but The business here is the knowledge is that the book and video contain, you know, and trying to get more. So I'm always excited when somebody's interested and wants to, you know, watch the video or read the book or both, because that means another person is possibly going to join up with us somehow to want to stop all this. And then that person, you know, can tell another person or show another person, and the hundredth monkey, you know, the grain of sand, the change of consciousness.
And that's what
happened. And I think it's happening. It's just we just have to all keep going, and we can't stop. You know, sometimes it seems so difficult, but
yeah. In response to my own question of what do we do next, it is just what you were saying, to keep on doing what you're doing and do more if you can. I was in Washington D.C. with my daughter a few years ago, 4 years ago, and just really got. The last time I'd been in Washington was for the inauguration of President Nixon at the tail end of the Vietnam War.
Oh,
and
my.
Wow.
There was hundreds of thousands. There was the biggest peace demonstration against the war to date. And there was there was virtually no media coverage of it because it was completely nonviolent.
Uh-huh.
And when we were in Washington, D.C. 4 years ago, we took a tour of the Capitol building via Sam Farr's office, our congressman here. And what I really got is that it's such a huge bureaucracy that its main job is to keep itself going. And yeah. if we wait for somebody as well-intentioned as President Obama is to change things from the top down, we're going to wait forever.
Begged us to join him.
We have to work from the bottom up, too. And
yeah.
what you're doing is that bottom-up work, and we just need to keep working.
And aren't you going to the School of Assassins demonstration reunion soon?
That's one of your segments. Actually, thanks for reminding me about that. It's actually 2 weeks from today I'm leaving. I'm flying to Atlanta, Georgia, and then I drive 2 hours to Columbus, Georgia, where Fort Benning is. And that's another segment of my video. The segment is called School of Assassins, and it's about the School of the Americas, which, you know, they've changed the name, but it's still the School of the Americas. It's our own terrorist training school, mm-hmm. which has been going for, I don't know, 40 years or something. They used to be in Panama, but it's been at Fort Benning for, I don't know, I think 20 years or something. And Father Roy Bourgeois, who's on my film, who's Marian Old Priest, who's been fighting to close the School of Americas all these years, he's the man who leads this big protest in front of Fort Benning. And I've gone the last 7 or 8 years. In the last 3 or 4 years, they've been getting about 25,000 people that come, spend 3 days out there, meeting, speaking. There's music. There's all kinds of activities going on. And we're out in front of the fort on Saturday all day. And then on Sunday is the big day that we march on Fort Benning peacefully, mm-hmm. peacefully to asking and demanding to close the School of Americas, which is a school, a U.S. training school that trains mostly soldiers from Latin, South, and Central America
mm-hmm.
to go back to their countries and oppress people and to torture people and to
assassinate people. It
trains
them in the art of torture, terrorism, and assassination.
Right.
And
it's the most amazing peace movement thing I've ever been to. Maybe outside of when I went to San Francisco right before the Iraq War started, this last Iraq War. A few weeks before the war started, I forget the date now, but there was like 200,000 people
that was there
that day. But at Fort Benning, it's such a, if anybody's listening who can possibly go, it's the most incredible experience. The people coming from all over the country and from other countries, Father Roy says half of these people are students. I don't doubt that because I've seen them. They're high school students and college students. And there's a lot of senior citizens mm-hmm. and everybody in between.
Yeah.
And these are all people that want to close the School of America, the School of Assassins. And they're, of course, against all the other wars. And it's just a fantastic 3 days of being together with people of like mind who were we're all peaceful. Father Roy is one of the all-time great human beings I've ever met. He's so mm-hmm. much like Brian Wilson. He went into the Navy and went to Vietnam. He was a Republican. He was, like Brian, a believer in the system. But, you know, throughout his experience, he came to see things were different. And he's been doing this battle to close the School of America's. And Roy is the most loving man you'll ever meet. He is the most sincere.
He have to be.
He is, and even his people that don't agree with him, like at the people at the Fort Benning at the School of America, I think they have to respect Roy because Roy is always positive. He's always friendly, even when he's speaking out against something so horrendous.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so important, you know, for people who speak out to be peaceful themselves. Which is not easy, by the way.
No.
Not easy. That man has spent over 4 years in prison for his protesting, Father Roy. And people that go over the fence at Fort Benning do get arrested, and they usually put them in prison for up to 6 months for just going over the fence and saying they stand against this school. But it's a great experience, and that's one of the segments of my film.
Yeah.
And that one is School of Assassins featuring Father Roy, talking about the School of America's in. It's narrated by Susan Sarandon.
Yes. And I guess the school, he said, was renamed Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation.
Wow.
A lot of us don't
great.
Know
I can never
it.
Remember that name. That's really good.
Well, no, I'm reading it.
Right.
I made a printout. I couldn't remember it either. I'm reading it from your
right.
website.
Yeah.
The school has since officially been renamed Western Hemisphere Institute
right.
for Security Cooperation.
Right.
What a misnomer.
They made it a name nobody can remember.
Yeah, I know it.
But
you had said it was renamed, so I went and did a little bit of research while you were talking to see what it was renamed. I didn't know that.
Well, the thing is that they've actually been voting in Congress to close the School of America now for years. And I guess last year they were like within 5 or 6 votes of officially closing it.
Yeah, Joseph Kennedy.
That, you know, that because of the work of Father Roy and all these people that work on this issue of the School of America, the main office of the School of America's watch is in Washington, D.C., and they've made the people in the government know about it, whether the, you know, a lot of them don't want to deal with it. But this is a great example of a group, an organization that's doing the best work, you know, out there. And if there's anybody listening who has the ability to go to Columbus, Georgia in 2 weeks from today, it actually starts on the Friday, I think it's the 20th, and it's Friday, Saturday, Sunday. It's just a really an incredible experience, and you can find out about it by going to the website, which is SOAW.org. That stands for School of the American Watch, SOAW.org, and all the information is there. I mean, I didn't go for years, and then when I finally went about 7 or 8 years ago for the first time, I've been back every year because it's just a fantastic experience to be there. And of course, I table there, and I bring hundreds of the books and videos with me. And every year, I literally send like 10 or 11 boxes of books and videos ahead. And every year when I get there, I think, God, what am I going to do with all this stuff? I'm not able to distribute. And every year it all goes. It all goes.
Well, they sell themselves.
Yeah. Of course,
if you just pick up the book.
$5 each. So.
I'm sorry?
I price them very reasonably. And then if somebody doesn't have the money in their suit, I'll just give it to them because, you know, it's important to get these materials out to people. And the people that go to Fort Benning to the School of America's protest, they are curious and eager for this information, the young people. The older people probably already know about this stuff, but mm-hmm. It's a very spiritual thing, I think. It is. There's a lot
it
of
is.
Religious leaders that come, or religious people. There's a lot of nuns and priests and people in the, you know, like Roy, he's a Marian old priest. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's one of the segments of my video. It's a great happening. Now, interesting enough, wouldn't you think that a story of 25,000 people marching on the Fort Benning would be a story for the news, but it's not covered in this country.
No, just an alternative news, an independent news media outlets usually cover it.
No, they cover it, sure. Amy
Goodman would.
Mm-hmm.
But that's how things work in this country. That's why we'll cover people don't know these things, because the mainstream media doesn't cover it.
Yeah. Right.
In the film The Panama Deception, it really covers it so well. There's a scene in there where Michael Parenti, the author,
yes.
professor, peace activist, you know, talks about how when we were invading Panama, the mainstream media, all they talked about is, you know, the tactical maneuvers, and a couple Americans were killed here and there. They didn't talk about that we were bombing out and burning down villages, whole neighborhoods, and killing people and with brute force. And he shows it so clearly, and you see it. The film actually shows that. They show the Ted Koppel and the others, Dan Rather and Peter Jennings, you know, they're telling their story, and then the film is showing what's really happening.
And they actively suppress the information.
Not yes,
just
they do.
Ignore it, but they'll taint it in a way that it's being suppressed.
Right.
It's all right. They say it's protecting our freedom.
We have free media here, free press here, but the people in the mainstream media, the deal is, if they do tell the truth, they won't keep their job very long, you know?
Yeah.
You know the story of Dan Rather?
I was just going to bring him up.
What's that?
I was just going to bring up Dan Rather.
Well, you know the story, I'm sure you know it, how he did that story on 60 Minutes 2, a couple years ago about George Bush Jr., that he didn't go to Vietnam, his father got him to go to Vietnam, but he was in the Air National Guard in Texas, but he didn't show up for like 8 months. That's a pretty big story for a guy who's president.
Yeah.
And he ran that story. It was all over the internet on the alternative media. And he ran this story, and it was a real story. It's true. And then they fired him after that.
And that's really minor.
The very interesting thing is last year I went to the alternative media conference, which is in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and where people like Amy Goodman and Bill Moyers and people from the Pacifica Networks and people like you were there, and, you know, people from Air America and, you know, people in the alternative media came, and you know who showed up there?
Who?
Dan Rather.
Dan Rather.
I couldn't believe it. It was the most funny thing.
Now.
Dan Rather was there. Why was he there? Because they kicked him out. They fired him from CBS.
Was Bill Moyers
there?
It
was pretty interesting. I didn't get a chance to talk to him, but He was like kind of like, you know, I don't think he was able to take it all in, but he did go.
Wow.
But that's an example of what
happened.
I would
have loved to have heard him speak.
Yeah, I heard him speak. You know, he was all right. But but at least he was there. You know, guy got to give him credit for actually being there. But Michael Prenti has a great audio tape about the way the media works. And there's a story he tells where this new reporter sees this great story about some atrocity the United States is committing, and he writes a story and brings it to his editor, and the editor reads the story and says, that's a good story, but we're not going to print it. And then another thing like that happens the second time, and the guy writes the story, and he goes back, but he goes, oh, my editor's not going to, you know, he's not going to okay it, so he doesn't bring it to him. The third time, he sees the story, but he doesn't bother to write it. And the fourth time, he never sees it anymore. Prenti told it was from someone else. But it basically is how it works.
How true.
How they're kind of trained not to really go there, because if they want to keep their job, they won't keep their job if they end up in the alternative, like, you know, like you guys are, like we are.
And so, the pressure to hold on, you don't know what their situation is. They may need that job, or they think they do.
Yeah.
So they have to train them to even bear being there day in and day out. They need to deny that truth,
right,
that at one point meant so much to them. But a part of them probably dies in the process.
Well,
they're all too human.
It's like if you're in the government. It's like, you know, if you're Cynthia McKinney, you know, congresswoman from Georgia, who I think was the most outspoken truth teller in our government.
She's great.
You know, they ran her out twice. You know, she's anti-American, un-American. She's unpatriotic. She's this, she's that. Oh, and all this money came in against her. So people, you know, Dennis Kucinich is one of the truth tellers in our government, but it's very hard to tell these truths and stay in the government, because what is the name of your show, The Belly of the Beast?
Tickling the Belly of the Beast from the heartland of Santa
that's
Cruz.
It, The Belly of the Beast, and if you're in the middle of it, it's really hard to be there and be the person trying to shine a light on all these people that don't want to see it.
Yeah, that's why I named it that. But there is another representative. I believe he's from Florida. I just heard him not long ago. I think it's Alan Grayson.
Right, I've heard of him.
Yeah, he's defending a lot of, well, he's speaking out against the war and for single payer still health care.
Right.
Many
other
concerns.
I think I saw him on Bill Maher. I didn't really get to see enough to see where he's really coming from, but I mean, there are people that in the government know these things, but you know, it's just for them, if they speak out, they're, you know, it's like the, I don't know what it's like. It's like the boy who cried wolf or something, except the wolf is real.
Yeah, it certainly is. Oh.
So, the more support we can give people in the government, if more people believe this stuff and stand up, maybe there's the ones that do know these things can speak out, you know. As far as Obama goes, I don't know where he's coming from. I don't know. I can't know.
Well, I'm sure he's watching.
All I know is the wars
a,
are continuing.
And
he's not ending them.
And he's walking
a tightrope.
He's
asked for more money. He could, for the military than Bush did,
which is not the direction we were hoping for.
And he's walking a tightrope right now as well. I'm sure he can only do so much without probably his family and he being in jeopardy.
Probably.
I don't say that lightly. Well, we're going to have to go pretty soon. We have at 5:05 Palestinian news. We're on a schedule, unfortunately. But
oh,
I want to
talk away the whole hour, huh?
Yes.
We did.
Sorry if I've been blabbing on here, you guys.
Oh, no, I've wanted you to. I'm grateful that you came on and shared with us your story and the work that you're doing to the production of The War Against the Third World and then publishing of Addicted to War. And do you want to just, your website again? What?
AddictedToWar.com is the website. AddictedToWar.com. And they can order the book there. They can find my video there. They can actually read the book online if they want to preview it before.
And then you have
there's lots of other good information on my website that people can, you know, take in if they choose to. And I work with a lot of other groups doing this work. It's all there. So.
And it's very informative. And you have another DVD. It looks like Arlington West, the film.
The Arlington West DVD is my friend Peter Jolly. It's the best anti-recruiting film I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the war in Iraq. They take that film into the high schools around here in Los Angeles, and they show it to whole assemblies, like 1,000 kids at a time, which is an amazing thing. And the kids want to enlist after they see it. Their film has no violence in it, so they can show it in the schools, but it's mostly interviews with soldiers who have been to Iraq and now, you know, are telling a different story than they were told when they first went there. It also has about 20 parents whose sons died in Iraq, including Cindy Sheehan.
Yeah.
Their film was very moving. It's very emotional. And it's, I could say, the best anti-recruiting film I've ever seen. And
wow.
So I work with Peter Stalley. And the other film on my video, on my website, is No More Victims. My friend Cole Miller, who has brought 10 war-injured Iraqi children to this country and helped them with medical treatments. And we send them back. We do fundraisers and send them back to Iraq with more money, some money, and a little better off. But what he's doing is so... not just helping those children and their families, but he's also, because Americans are helping, he ends up on the mainstream media with these children. And, he's able to say on the mainstream media that there was, these injuries were are the result of the U.S. collateral damage. And, the people, the anchors don't cut them off or argue with them. They actually repeat it. I think it's because there's Americans helping.
Well, those
but it's just
inroads.
A different way, all different ways of trying to, you know, get people to see this information and take it into their heart.
Well, Frank, thank you so much, and for all the work that you're doing and that you've put together. And, you know, we'll have to talk to you again when you get back from the School of the Assassins. Maybe you can call us from there. You have our phone number. All right.
Yes, thank you
so
much,
Frank. Thanks for having me on, you guys.
Oh, thank you.
And thanks for what you're doing.
Oh, you. Thank you.
Vice versa.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Bless you. Take care.
This is We Are Free, and then we're going to put on Palestinian news, because now we are free.
Ani say he was coerced into confessing.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, November 5th, 2009. The Israeli military kidnaps 18 civilians from the West Bank and allows food supplies into the Gaza Strip. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. The Israeli military kidnapped on Thursday 18 Palestinians during attacks targeting a number of West Bank communities. Local Palestinian sources reported that five of those kidnapped were from the northern West Bank city of Nablus, while the rest were divided between Jenin and Qalqilia cities, also in northern West Bank, in addition to Hebron City in the south.